Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. We are diving back into the world of Star Wars.
Have we ever not been in the world of Star Wars for the past, like, 5 years, Jonathan?
Not really. But we have been doing an ongoing project talking about all of the original six George Lucas-led Star Wars movies.
Pre-Disney Star Wars movies.
Pre-Disney Star Wars movies. We've been going in the narrative chronological order, prequels to the original trilogy, and we arrive today at what is probably the best Star Wars movie.
The best Star Wars movie. It's
but we will talk about that. Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
Is it still a good movie, Sean?
It's really fucking good.
It's a really good movie. So, you know, if you've never seen The Empire Strikes Back, go watch it. Yeah. I don't know who you are, and I don't know how you're listening to this particular podcast.
Yes, like, it's, if you're someone who's not seen Empire Strikes Back in the world, that's fine. I don't know how you've not seen Empire Strikes Back and listened to this podcast. That is not a Venn diagram that exists. That's right. Impossible.
But if somehow we're introducing you to this wonderful movie, watch Star Wars first, and then watch Empire. Yeah.
Honestly, you probably know enough about Star Wars that you wouldn't even need to watch the first movie. It's the movie worth watching. But
they blow up a Death Star.
Yep.
And then the next one, they blow up a Death Star again.
Yeah.
But we'll get there.
We're in the nice middle chapter where there are no Death Stars.
No Death Stars in this one. But yes, and Sean, I have to tell you, we're going to have to do Return of the Jedi pretty soon, because I really just wanted to, like, put in the next movie after this was done. So, yeah, anyway, we will be talking about that in our normal detail, doing a full in-depth discussion.
Yep.
Our second space movie in 2 weeks, because we did 2001 last week. But this is a good primer on what sci-fi is and what fantasy is, because they are two different genres.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, we'll get into that. Yeah, we're going to do a couple pieces of news. We're going to do some stuff. Sean, what have you been up to? Anything worth talking about?
There's not, as we kind of talked a little bit before we recorded the podcast, Jonathan, that has not been that long since we recorded the last podcast.
It has not, because we're trying to get back on a normal post-E3 schedule.
Yeah, so it's only been about half a week since we recorded the last podcast. So I haven't done much, but I now have to come on here at, like, 4 or 5 days after the last time we talked and say, I'm not going to finish Rise of the Tomb Raider. Okay. It's just not going to happen. Like,
I'm sorry.
There is something about when I brought it up on last week's podcast, the last podcast, there was a part of me that was hoping, Jonathan, that you were going to, like, encourage me to push me through, and I was very surprised when we started having the conversation that you were like, yeah, no, actually, I started playing the first new Tomb Raider, and you're maybe right, Sean. I'm like, oh, no.
No, I didn't push you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it kind of deflated me a bit, and then I started playing it, and I mean, I put probably 4 or 5 more hours in from the last time we talked, and nothing really changed much. And the thing that broke, the straw that broke the camel's back is how fucking long in that game's plot that they hold off the reveal. Spoiler for, I technically have not even seen this reveal, so I might technically be wrong. I'm not wrong about this plot twist, but, like I said, I have not actually gotten this part of the game because I just gave up at some point. But so maybe weird spoiler warning for Rise of the Tomb Raider. There's a character named Jacob who is the prophet.
Uh-huh.
He's the immortal prophet. He is the immortal fucking prophet, because the whole setup of the game, the sort of like Indiana Jones supernatural thing, is that Lara's dad, like, was after some, they call it by like 500 different names. It's like the source of God or all this shit. But like this thing that's basically the Holy Grail that makes you immortal. And Lara's dad was after that. And then he was assassinated, but people want Lara to think that he committed suicide, even though he was very clearly assassinated by the Shadowy Organization, Trinity. That also has not been revealed. Fucking shit, right? Yeah. This game is very bad at setting up its plot twist in a way that, like there's a way to set up an obvious plot twist and have it not bother me. This game does not do it that way. This game makes it feel like it's supposed to be a surprise and holds off on it, and it doesn't do it.
The Tomb Raider games are sort of written from a perspective of, it sounds like they aren't aware that they're not doing this for the first time.
Yeah, it's like somebody somehow, like, stumbled upon this and had never seen an Indiana Jones movie.
Here's what I think it is. It feels like someone, like, wrote down all the cliches they wanted to use, got hit on the head, lost their long-term memory, and then wrote a plot based on all of that without knowing that they weren't riffing on these. They were just thought they were doing them for the first time.
Yeah, they're just reproducing it entirely. Yeah. But anyways, back to the plot. So yeah, you're going after the immortal thing that your dad was after and was assassinated/maybe committed suicide, but was assassinated for. And then Lara in the events of the first Tomb Raider, this new Tomb Raider game, the 2013 Tomb Raider, encountered supernatural bullshit on that island, and so she's like, oh, maybe my dad was actually right about the supernatural bullshit, and so I should go after the same supernatural bullshit that he was going after. And so her whole, like, motivation is that she believes in the supernatural is supposed to be the thing. Like, she's already encountered the supernatural. She's fucked, but she scullies all through this game of, like, keep on saying, like, oh, yeah, I've encountered the supernatural, I believe in the supernatural, but then is never actually, like, sort of aware of or analytical of anything happening around her from a point of view that assumes the supernatural is real. Because if she did, she would immediately come to the conclusion upon meeting Jacob that he was the prophet that she is following through all of history, that, like, 2,000 years of history or whatever, that this guy, the prophet, got the immortal thing, was using the immortal thing, and that Trinity, the shadowy organization, basically the Templars from Assassin's Creed, have been following him and trying to get the magic doodad from him so that they could be immortal also. And so you know, you the player and Lara Croft the human being knows that the prophet has the immortal thing and lived for far longer than any normal human could, encounters this guy who is the leader of the people that guard the immortal thing that is, like, very suspected, weird, and, like, talks in weird ways and is like, just mysterious for no good reason. Like, this Jacob dude is very bad at playing off that he's, like, a normal human because he's clearly hiding a massive secret. That would be one thing if you do that, and, like, that, and you just hold off on that plot twist, because, again, I'm pretty close to the end of that game. I'm not going to finish it. And they still haven't done it. It was, like, the last conversation I had with him, between him and Lara, he was still trying to pass off like he was the prophet. Lara doesn't question anything that ever happens in that game. She's, like, the most fucking just naive protagonist you could possibly have. She doesn't assume bad of anybody at all, or that, like, anyone might be lying to her. And so she's still just, like, oh, okay, yeah, the prophets must be dead, and you must be the descendants of the prophet, not you being the prophet. Because halfway through the fucking game, she walks into a room with a giant statue, she looks at the giant statue and says, that's a giant statue of the prophet. And you know who that giant statue looks 100% exactly like? It's a fucking statue of Jacob. Like, she literally just sees it. It's just there. And the camera doesn't linger on it in the cinematic, but you can just look at it, and it just looks like Jacob. It's like, how do you do that? How do you write, like, make this game and make it seem like Lara Croft is the stupidest person on the planet? It's infuriating.
Don't watch the movie.
Okay.
If you want all of that, just worse.
Yeah.
No. Yeah, it's infuriating. You're explaining a lot of this to me. I still don't remember how all the pieces go together because it's such a convoluted story. But I'll tell you this, Sean, if you don't feel like you can make it to the end, I'll tell you, have you played the end of Uncharted 1, 2, or 3?
Yes.
They go into a lost city.
I've played all those games multiple times.
And they go into a lost city, and the lost city is kind of cool, but there's also a bad guy there, and they get some magical power, and then you have a final boss fight that's probably pretty bad with them, and then you kill them, and then you get out of the lost city while it's crumbling, and then you, like, high-five with your mates.
Yeah.
You've played the end of Rise of the Tomb Raider.
Good.
Like, but without the Naughty Dog writing and gameplay and graphics.
Yeah, because that's the thing is, like, I you know, I'm always someone who's, like, you know, plot twists don't exist just to surprise you, and that's their only value. I firmly believe that in writing. Like, that's just patently true. But again, there are ways to do this stuff and do these tropes that doesn't just make it feel like they think I'm an idiot, is what it feels like. It feels like the writing just assumes there's no way anybody playing this game could ever, ever notice that Jacob is actually the prophet, even though, again, I have to stress the fact that they show you a statue of the prophet, they tell you it's a statue of the prophet, and they just make it look like Jacob. Like, the dude didn't even get, like, change his hairstyle in 2,000 fucking years.
We're going to talk about a pretty famous plot twist later today.
Yeah.
Maybe we can do some compare and contrast.
Okay, yes.
All right. Well, that's Rise of the Tomb Raider. I've been playing a lot more of Splatoon 2.
Cool.
Which I talked about last week. I talked about the Octo expansion. I have now finished the Splatoon 2 Octo expansion. When I beat the game, like, rolled credits, I had not done every single level because some of them are so hard that I'm just like, I'm going to save these for the post game,
right.
You know? And I did that, but I have gone back and I've now beaten everything in the Octo expansion except the final secret boss, who there is a final secret boss. I'm pretty sure it's impossible. I have not beaten that yet, and I don't know if I ever will. but that's okay. I feel pretty accomplished beating everything else because the Octo expansion is one of the most excruciatingly difficult games I have ever played, certainly to completion. It's also one of the best. It is so darn good. That entire game is just an absolute bastion of creativity and variety and, you know, platforming and shooting ingenuity, puzzle ingenuity. It really is something of a masterwork of that, of whatever weird genre you think Splatoon falls into, because it's kind of five different ones. Right. I don't know if I've had more fun, like pure fun playing a game this year. It is definitely one of the games of the year to me. And where it goes in like the last hour or two, once you find the four things that you have to find on the train and you assemble the four things and the plot twist that happens, and then they kind of throw you into this final gauntlet of levels that you have to play through to the end. That whole stretch is out of this world good. The final boss is out of this world good and hard. And, like, the scale of what happens at the end is crazy. I was surprised at how much I found myself caring about the weird Splatoon characters and world and story at the end. There is a stealth section near the end of this game that you have to do where, like, you're dropped somewhere without any kind of weapon or protection. But you can still turn into, like, the squid and ink through things, and you have to do stealth inking. One of the coolest things I've played, I now want Metal Gear Splatoon, where you are a, Snake becomes a squid kid. And now he has to do stealth stuff.
There's some sort of incomprehensible plot that's maybe commenting on, like, nuclear disarmament or something in a roundabout way.
There can be a 3-hour diatribe about the Octoling-Inkling conflict.
Yeah.
Yes, that also gets into, like, the internet or something.
Yeah, like, information dissemination. It's like, oh.
Yeah. Anyway, but what was I trying to say?
I don't know.
Right. Stealth stuff, yeah. It is amazing how frequently the Octo expansion is able to just take these, because it doesn't like necessarily introduce things that have never existed in Splatoon. Like the guns are from Splatoon, the powers are from Splatoon. It's all stuff that you could go get in the main game and play in multiplayer, but they constantly bend and twist all these mechanics to their will to do all these crazy things. Like it enters so many genres of games over the course of that expansion and that story mode they give you. And it is insane that they're able to do that with just these, the basic mechanics that exist in Splatoon. Because it also shows you how ludicrously deep the system that they've built for gameplay in these games is. And I hope this is, like, not the last single-player expansion. Who knows? Maybe the next thing is Splatoon 3.
Right.
That probably is coming in the next few years, I would assume.
I assume so, yeah.
So maybe that's the next thing, and I hope it has a single-player mode as robust as the Octo expansion is. But I hope they do more with this, because it is so ludicrously impressive. And I've also, because I've been playing that side of the game, I've also gotten back into the Splatoon 2 multiplayer and just played a shit ton of that because it is so fun, it is so fast, it is so surprisingly competitive. I've talked about this on the podcast before, but far and away the most competitive multiplayer matches online I've ever seen are in Splatoon, of all things. Because when you're playing like an online shooter, like a Call of Duty or a Halo or something, I feel like you're lucky when you get like a super close match that's back and forth. Because oftentimes, and this wasn't as true back in the day, I feel like today it's much more of a thing where they're just a blowout one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, like, you have stuff with like the way that progression mechanics work, particularly with Call of Duty, when you have kill streaks and all that on top of it.
Yeah.
It definitely, they encourage like a sort of like steamroll, like rolling a snowball down a hill kind of game design.
Destiny is very much like that in its PvP. Yeah. But Splatoon, like, it's the main mode is the you ink the surface of the map, and it grades how much you've inked at the end. And sometimes, sometimes there are blowouts, no doubt. But I'm surprised that, like, at least a couple times a day, I have a match that's, like, within 0.2 of a percentage point difference. That's ridiculous. Like, if you inked, like, if someone had fired one more drop of ink out of their gun, it would have turned the game. Like, it is wild how competitive the game can feel and how you really, like, because they're four-person teams, you really feel like, okay, this gun is wrong, I'm going to change my gun, and then you feel like you are making a real impact on, like, the flow of the game. Because, like, your actions, like, really feel like you can feel yourself moving the boulder, which you don't always in multiplayer. But it's so good, and I've been thinking about how, you know, we've had all these conversations lately about Destiny 2 has kind of fallen off the map for a lot of people.
Sure, yeah.
Anthem is coming out, which is going to be something Destiny-esque, we think.
Probably.
Bethesda is doing Fallout 76, which is also this kind of online shared world experience. And we've kind of been wondering, can this thing, this new genre that basically propped up this generation with Destiny. Can this work long term? And I don't know. Bethesda and BioWare still have to go up to bat, and they are very good at what they do.
Yeah.
And we'll see. But I honestly think all these companies making these games should look at Splatoon 2. And that's a weird thing to say because they are, you know, Splatoon is not a game about killing people or exploring a giant world. But what it does do is, I think, have a really savvy, like, hook on how you do, like, rewarding single-player, like, campaign, you know, crafted experiences versus online player engagement stuff. And I think one of the things it does smartly, which is not new, this is how games used to do it, is the iron wall between them, but an iron wall that has holes in it. Like, things do go back and forth. You get items in the single player, you can use them in the multiplayer, and, you know, there are ways they come back to, you know, back and forth, like, you know, getting, like, the Octo expansion has made me so much better at Splatoon multiplayer because I just understand the mechanics better, things like that. But, you know, for the campaign, they don't have to, you know, use, like, the multiplayer maps or some world they've made primarily for online stuff. They can make these crafted linear campaign spaces where what you do is really tailored to what they want to do with the mechanics there, and it's super rewarding. And then if you want to go play online stuff, that's a separate thing where the mechanics are the same, but what you do with it is different, and they have both PvE and PvP modes in Splatoon's online.
Right, they have like a horde mode kind of thing, right?
Yeah, they have that, yeah. And so you can do both of those, and there is this huge communal aspect that happens, and it is a game that is constantly being updated. They're constantly adding things. They're constantly doing community events. I played yesterday a bunch because it was the Splatfest for OJ. Should we have pulp or no pulp?
And I have no opinion on this matter.
Okay. I have no strong opinion. I picked pulp because that's probably what I prefer. But yeah, some people feel very strongly about it. But pulp won, and I was on that team, so I felt very good. But anyway, I'm glad they didn't do OJ. Did he do it? Did he not do it?
Like, there's that's a much clearer split.
It is, but it would be fun to have, like, the 90% of the did it team, and you just fire blood red ink.
Jesus.
And the no did it team is 10%, and I don't know what
you're
doing.
And they just program the game so they can't fire ink, and they just lose, because it's like, just come on, guys, please.
Yeah.
At this point, really?
Anyway, but yeah, what were we talking about? The Splatfest stuff, and that's just such a fun communal thing they do. And I don't know, I think Splatoon kind of has a grasp on the basics of how a multiplayer game should work that I actually think a lot of games are maybe losing sight of, like the forest for the trees kind of thing, in complicating, like, we can do these big online things where everything happens in the exact same space, and I think there's maybe been too much of people not asking, should we do it? Not, can should we? I don't know.
I mean, part of where it comes from, obviously, is, like, MMOs, right?
Yeah.
And so it's trying to find a way to take what is the fundamental MMO experience and translate it to more accessible, console-friendly genres and that are way more skill-based in gameplay. So something like a Destiny or Division or Anthem are way more active, obviously, than a World of Warcraft or Guild Wars or whatever, you know? And so it is like, I think that's like the really evolving space of the shared world shooter, action, whatever. Like, we don't really have a name for the genre yet of like this bizarre mix of first-person shooter and MMO and, like, loot the Diablo stuff that's not quite the same as what they did in WoW and that kind of stuff, and then trying to push forward in that genre. But I think there's definitely still room for the, like, and because there's still room for, and there are still lots of the, like, clear delineated, like, I guess Call of Duty's kind of getting rid of the single player now, but that is how those kind of games work. Is like, here's your, like, pillars of...
But Call of Duty is almost too delineated in how split it is. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Of, like, we talked about this with Infinite Warfare a lot, that you could just pluck that campaign out and sell it on its own. Because there's no... The single player and the multiplayer are different games in Call of Duty these days. They are just... They're different things. They have different mechanics. They play differently. Like, they are... They might as well sell them separately. Part of what I'm saying is Splatoon is not that. Like, I think you could subdivide them off, but it's not... Like I said, it's kind of the iron curtain that you can play one of them offline and separate and on your own, but with holes in it in that they go back and forth more.
But, but isn't it mostly just, like, you unlock a weapon?
Unlock a weapon, but also, like, I think, again, I think the way it plays with mechanics and, like, the main, like, single-player mode in the game, like, how it's also built somewhat to, like, teach you the multiplayer stuff.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, from what I understand, that's basically what people have said about the past few Battlefield campaigns.
Yeah.
Is that they are set up in such a way to teach you, like, okay, like, this is the campaign focused around, like, the tank driver and driving the tank and, like, all the mechanics around that and destruction.
I guess, here's what I'm thinking, though. Like, if Destiny 2 had just been that campaign and I could easily subdivide that off, Destiny 2 would have been on my top 10 last year. I'm pretty sure. Because I think that's a great Bungie first-person shooter campaign. But then it gets thrown in the same pot as the PvE stuff out in the world, in the same areas, and the PvP stuff, which is so weird and separate in Destiny and doesn't feel like they know what to do with it. And it's all kind of in the same pot, and it all kind of simmers in the same place. And over time, it all sort of gets diluted for me, because I don't feel like anything is designed specifically for, like, one purpose. It all has to do five different things. And I just wonder if there's a point in game design where you have to be more crafted and focused in what you're doing. And it's just a thought I've had, because this is all kind of banging around in my head as I started playing this mode, because this came out middle of E3,
right.
You know? Because I think that's, like, a huge open question we all have about Anthem, is can the things that make BioWare special translate to when, you know, we talk about this, like, BioWare's combat is great in Mass Effect 2 and 3, when it has to do what Mass Effect 2 and 3 ask of it in specific situations.
Yeah, but the bulk of that game is walking around, talking to characters, like, engaging with the story in the setting, and then you have, like, specific combat sections.
Right, but what about the point where in Anthem, the combat has to be for story, and for PvE stuff, and for PvP stuff, and all this other stuff in the world, and it has to be doing five different things. And when the story stuff has to be also accommodating a game where you are not the one character, there's a million of you out in the world, and you have to figure out how to write for that and around that, which was something Bungie crashed headlong into a wall on in Destiny.
You know, I mean, they basically didn't really try. Like, it's always, that's something that's always been weird with the MMO kind of thing, is the how do you write for...
Right.
I think there are ways to do it, and I think from what I've heard, there are, like, some, like, the more obscure MMOs, like Secret World, do interesting things around that concept of you're... Like, you can't be in that kind of thing. You can't be, like, the one great hero that has come and solved all the problems of the world, which is basically what it kind of feels like they want your guardian to be in Destiny, in most of the main curated stuff. But then, like, when you're doing the PvE stuff, there's a good... Like, by PvE, I mean, like, out in the world, like, going around doing public events, that kind of shit. There is a better sense there of, oh, I'm, like, one part in, like, a greater, like, organization trying to fight against the forces of darkness.
Right.
And trying to, yeah, like, navigate those waters, I think, is really difficult. But I am really interested to see that move forward, because it's the one thing about this, not just the one thing, but one of the major things about this generation of consoles and video games associated with this generation of consoles that feels like it's trying to do something very new, and it's, like, really messy right now, but it typically is very messy when you're getting started with that kind of shit, and then eventually, I mean, maybe they'll never, like, quite crack it, because it seems like it is a very hard thing to do. But it would be cool to see, like, other people's takes on how do you try to do this much more unified, seamless experience between these different modes of play.
Yeah. It's why I'm so fascinated in Fallout 76, because it feels like...
A very different take on it.
And it feels like they're maybe aiming the closest to the center of the dartboard of, like, nailing it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It's just something that I've been thinking about. Splatoon 2 is really fucking good, you guys. If you don't own a Switch... You know, I don't know if this game alone is worth buying for it, but Switch has plenty of great games. And if you own a Switch, you should own Splatoon 2. You should get the Octo expansion, play all this stuff.
Especially if you have a Switch, you should get it now so you can play it online before you have to pay for it.
That's true.
A couple months you can get it. A
couple months, yeah. But, yeah, I love this fucking game. I actually think there's a lot the industry could learn from looking at it, because people like to focus on it doesn't have native voice chat and you have to use the app. Okay, the matchmaking is faster than any game I've ever played. Period. Like, the way you roll through matches, I've never had lag, I've never had connectivity issues in a match. Like, before a match, it will kick me out, which is the responsible thing for netcode to do.
Right.
If it knows you're gonna, like, it can't service you. But, like, it's insane how good it all works. And, yeah, I love this game. I was looking this up, I did not remember. This game has sold ludicrously well.
Yeah.
It sold, like, over 6 million copies worldwide. It's also broken 2 million copies in Japan alone. That's the first game this decade to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's going to be Splatoon 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
They're going to keep making Splatoon for sure.
Yes. Yeah. It's a big thing.
I hope that also encourages Nintendo to do that more with, like, making new franchises. Because that was a thing.
It's like their Overwatch.
Like, I just have always admired Splatoon from the outside since, like, it was first announced of being like, holy shit, Nintendo's actually making a new franchise. This is the first time in, like, a fucking decade that they've tried to make a new IP.
People are catching the bug. Like, Bethesda, their first new one in 25 years with Starfield. The fourth B, Blizzard with Overwatch. There you go. Their first new IP in forever. Sorry.
The fourth B.
Yeah. Well, Blizzard, BioWare, Bungie, Bethesda. There's a lot of Bs.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, what I was trying to say. So, like, everyone's getting the bug of, like, we're going to make new IPs.
This is good. It took a long time. Like, Guerrilla with Horizon Zero Dawn and Sucker Punch with Ghost of Tsushima.
Yeah.
We're getting, we are definitely getting... It was a long time coming for the end of the last generation and this generation so far. Yeah. Very scant on new IPs.
So, speaking of other games, I have only played a little bit of Mario Tennis Aces. I did pick that up for Switch. Right. I will give you guys a fuller take on that next week, but I've been really into Splatoon, so I haven't played a ton of it yet. I have played a couple hours of like multiplayer with my brother and a little bit online. It is insanely fun. It is like the general consensus I've seen forming around Mario Tennis Aces is that there are some disappointing things about it, like the single player is not as fleshed out as people would like, but that the main like tennis mechanics are insanely good, and they are. Like, just playing it like together without any tutorial stuff and like figuring it out has been crazy fun. It's been felt very competitive. There's new depth to it I'm discovering with every match we do. It's a really interesting game, and I am looking forward to playing more of it and talking about that with you guys.
Cool.
Because it feels like a Mario Tennis or a Mario Sports game that's like, for the first time in a while, is like, this is worth it. Oh my god. Because that series kind of just went into sleep mode for a while.
Yeah. It's just like the Mario Sports stuff has been very up and down over the years for sure.
Yeah. So that's cool. And then I did want to talk about one movie, Sean.
Okay.
Not a new movie. Because I did not go see Jurassic World.
I didn't. Yeah.
A lot of people did. It made $150 million somehow. I don't know who's going to see the Jurassic Park movies at this point. I never hear about anyone excited in them. I never talk to anyone about them. But somehow, just dinosaurs have a magnetic pull at the box office.
I guess.
Yeah.
Which you would think that more people would try to make more dinosaur movies, which would make me happy, but...
Yeah. Finally, a dinosaur movie with feathers.
Yes, let's get it. And you can't just, like, do this fucking lampshade bullshit, being like, oh, we know it's feathers, so we're going to put a line to dialogue of, like, oh, dinosaurs with feathers are lame, so we're going to genetically engineer the feathers out of them. It's like, fuck off. Use your platform to educate the public, assholes.
Yes, anyway, I might go see that Jurassic Park movie at some point, because I am so morbidly curious in it.
Never.
Okay.
It will never happen.
All right.
Anyway. I still have Jurassic Parks 2, 3, and 4 to see before I see Jurassic Park 5.
That's...
I gotta catch up on the franchise.
There are a couple of sequences I would recommend to you in Jurassic Park 2.
And I'm pretty sure I've seen those sequences. Because I have seen parts of Jurassic Park 2. I've never sat down and watched the entire... Yeah. The part where, like, the thing is the, like, camp or whatever is dangling off the edge. That's a
great
sequence.
Great action sequence. There are no good sequences in 3 or 4, so you can skip those.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's... But here's the movie I did want to talk about, which is... We did a big piece on 2001 last week.
Yep.
That was very fun. It also gave me some Stanley Kubrick fever of, you know, as we talked about...
That's dangerous to have.
I know. There are some other Kubrick movies I still have not seen, because I kind of... Part of it is, as I said last week, he's got such a daunting filmography, you've got to kind of spread him out a little. Part of it also for me has been, like, he only has, like, 10 movies. I don't want to just see them all and then not have new Stanley Kubrick movies.
Yeah, I definitely have that with some people. Like, that's kind of me with Kurosawa, the last few Kurosawa movies I haven't seen. It's just, like, I kind of don't want to see them so that there's always a Kurosawa movie I haven't seen out there somewhere.
Yeah. So anyway, but I did do the next step for me this week, which is I sat down and watched all 3 hours of Barry Lyndon.
Nice.
Have you ever seen Barry Lyndon?
Yeah.
Barry Lyndon is such a good fucking movie.
It's good.
Barry Lyndon is an obscenely good movie. I wanted to talk about it because it is also an obscenely weird movie.
Yeah. I think that's one I need to go back to because I haven't watched it. I only saw it once in high school.
You were probably too young to...
Yeah. And I feel like Barry Lyndon is to me what 2001 was to you before you rewatched it in this, like, theatrical thing of, like, I respected a lot of Barry Lyndon and I thought it was good, but, like, I didn't, like, get attached to it in any big way.
Yeah, so I have the... They did a... Criterion got this film and did a big edition of it, because Barry Lyndon had, like, literally never had a DVD release with special features.
Right, yeah.
So Criterion... And never had, like, a proper restoration and everything. So I had picked up the Criterion Blu-ray a few months ago on a sale, but I hadn't watched it yet. And took the time, watched it, soaked in it, because it is a big, long, warm bath of a movie. Barry Lyndon is one of the greatest films ever made. Hmm. It is also one of the weirdest. Like, because it is, if you don't know, this is Stanley Kubrick's period piece. It is, he had just come off, you know, Doctor Strangelove, Clockwork Orange, 2001, all these, like, future or near-future movies that have sci-fi elements or something kind of off about their presentation of reality. And this time, it took him 5 years to make this one, and he goes way back to the past, 1700s England, and it is the story of this guy, Redmond Barry, who is this sort of douchey Irishman who sort of connives his way through the social ranks until he marries a witch, a rich widow, takes her dead husband's last name, which is kind of weird, and becomes Barry Lyndon, and then it is about his... It's very literally, it's a part one, part two movie with an intermission in the middle, yeah. And part one is his rise, and part two is his fall. And it is based on a very obscure William Makepeace Thackeray novel. He's the guy who wrote Vanity Fair, is his famous book, but this is not one of his famous books, but it was very clearly this thing where Kubrick read the book and saw what he could do with it, and then did his own thing with it. I think you would have, like, kind of like The Shining or something.
Oh, yeah, where, like, The Shining is very different from the book.
Yeah. This is, I think, that the plot moves in the same way as the Thackeray book, but is tonally quite different. Because the movie is, like, one thing, that the famous thing about Barry Lyndon is that it is, I think, on anyone who, like, thinks about cinematography, it is on the shortlist of the best shot movies of all time. Because it is shot to look like a series of 18th century paintings, 18th century English paintings, and it really does. Like, it has super, like, low depth of field, so it's all very flat, and it has this very, you know, rich grain structure and texture, and, like, all of the exterior scenes, just that everything is so perfectly, exactingly composed. I don't know how he got, like, people to do that, like, stand in the positions they need. Like, they look like they are sitting in portrait, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And all the interiors, when it's at night, they're all shot by candlelight, which up until Barry Lyndon was considered impossible because you cannot light a scene based on just a candle. But that is obviously how houses were lit in the 1700s. Yeah. So Kubrick is like, we're going to figure out how to do it. And he used a new lens that had been invented for NASA to shoot the movie so that he could have enough range on the lens to shoot in the low light of candlelight. So, like, this movie is one of the most beautiful films ever made. It also has some of the most just exacting period detail costumes and production design. They shot it 100% on actual locations, including actual places in England and Ireland, but also, like, literal mansions and houses and castles and things. It's crazy. Like, you watch the behind-the-scenes stuff, and Kubrick made the costume designers. All the costumes had to be designed based on paintings and drawings from the time. They couldn't just, like, invent new costumes. Right. It had to be, like, there was historical detail for everything in it. And that is one of the things the film is famous for. It's, like, it won all the Oscars for the below-the-line stuff, all the technical stuff that year. It is known for being, like, this just incredibly lavish production of a period piece sort of thing. It took 300 days to shoot, an entire year. Not Kubrick's longest shooting period. That's The Shining. Took over a year. Which, if you don't know that about The Shining, that's why Shelley Duvall looks so sad in it.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, so, like, that's what it's known for. And what you would expect is a stuffy costume drama, knowing all of that. And it both is and it isn't.
Yeah.
Because what it is, I think, Kubrick's most subversive movie, because it looks like it doesn't look like, but it has kind of the airs of that sort of stuffy, very period-specific costume drama. And it is a vicious social satire under the surface about, to me, just, like, the utter inane bullshit of the British aristocracy and any sort of, like, aristocratic class system. This movie, I said this on Twitter, if you strip away all of the beautiful cinematography and the production design and all that stuff, this movie is 5 degrees from Monty Python. Hmm. It feels like it could be, like, if you cut the budget down to $100,000 and had a bunch of Monty Python people in it, it would feel like a sequel to Monty Python and the Holy Grail sent much later in English history, because that is how, like, just silly so much of the shit that happens in this movie is, how absurd it presents things, but with this, like, very particular Kubrick sheen of everything being perfectly in place. And it is such a weird experience to watch because it's 3 hours long and it moves like glacially slowly. And I couldn't look away from it. It is one of the most entertaining movies because of how weird the performances are, how like slyly funny a lot of the things that happen are, how much it feels like it's both like using this sort of beautiful 18th century language, but also very much making fun of it. It's got this narrator who comments on the action in the most like backhanded ways. It's an incredible movie. It is such a bizarre movie. It has pockets of where I find it very funny, where I find it very like intelligent and observational. There's a stretch near the end that is super emotional in an interesting way. It's got incredible like character dynamics through it. When I say weird performances, the main character is played by this guy, Ryan O'Neill, who I think was like a boxer or a male model or something. And kind of, have you ever seen the James Bond movie with the guy who did it once in it? It's on Her Majesty's Secret Service.
No.
Okay, and it's funny because that's considered like the best James Bond movie, but has the worst James Bond in it. Yeah. And that James Bond is famous because he's such a wooden doll. It's that exact same effect, but in this movie. And Barry Lyndon is basically just this guy who goes through the movie and things happen to him, but he is like, it feels like he's watching his own movie from outside of it. It's such, so bizarre, and people have for years like tried to figure out, is Ryan O'Neill bad or is that what Kubrick wanted? That's what Kubrick fucking wanted. Uh-huh. Like, 10 minutes into the movie, you realize, okay, that's what he wanted, and it is so weird. But yeah, I fucking love this movie. I had to talk about it and get it off my chest because it is so wild. You should totally watch it. Know what you're getting in for. But if you like Stanley Kubrick, if you've liked any of his other movies, like, honestly, this one is closer to Dr. Strangelove than it is to 2001 or A Clockwork Orange or any of those. In a weird way. Because Dr. Strangelove is a comedy. That is, on its surface, that's what it is. Barry Lyndon is not. Like, it is not sorted under comedy at the video store or something. Or
the video store.
Or the iTunes store now. But I think that is kind of in its heart of hearts what it is. And it is the most lavishly produced comedy of all time. Stanley Kubrick was an insane person.
Oh, God, yeah.
I love the guy. Because you also like to have all these bonus features of everyone talking about, because he's not alive to talk for himself anymore. Although they do have audio recordings of him talking about the movie, which is cool.
Cool.
Because I had never heard his voice. But you just hear everyone else talking about it, and with both great respect and in some cases great confusion.
Which is like how I feel like most actors who worked with him particularly talk about it is like, I don't know what the fuck he was doing.
But Stanley
he's
Kubrick,
kind of an asshole some of the time, he's kind of awesome some of the time, and the movie came out and people loved it, I guess, I don't know.
Some of Kubrick's movies to me really are Trojan horse films where what they look like on the surface is not what they are underneath. I think this is one of them. I think Full Metal Jacket is very much one of them.
Oh, yeah.
And Eyes Wide Shut is kind of the ultimate one of that to me. And those are kind of my favorite Kubricks, because I love just how much those movies zig when you expect them to zag, and how much they are in active conversation with sort of their own, like, aesthetic material being, with their own generic definitions. It's really fascinating thing.
And then also the way that the, like, larger pop culture narrative and understanding of those movies have formed around, like, very particular elements that give you a preconception about it. Like, particularly for Full Metal Jacket, I think this is very true. And then when you actually watch the movie, you realize that is not what this movie is at all. Like, that's just, like, the flashy part of the movie that got, like, snagged on the pop cultural subconscious. But it is not what... But when you actually watch the movie, it's like, oh, that's not what this movie is doing.
Yeah, I mean, starting with 2001, every movie he made until his death had either poor or mixed critical reception, and then 10 years later was considered one of the best movies ever made.
Yeah.
And they were just these slow-ticking time bombs that he would drop, they would go off a couple years later, and he'd be on to the next thing. Or dead, in the case of Eyes Wide Shut. So
thank God that Stanley Kubrick was not around in the days of Twitter. I can't imagine how horrifying the 2001 or Barry Lyndon hot takes on Twitter would have been.
I mean, it's a real thing to talk about because there wouldn't be a Stanley Kubrick today. Like, I honestly do worry about that sometimes. I don't think we go back and reevaluate things the same way we would have at one point. I think the movie universe is like a bunch of fucking piranhas and they just take all the meat off whatever is there and leave it to just float belly up in its skeleton.
Yeah.
I don't think Stanley Kubrick would have survived the 2000s. Like, he died at the exact right time for his career, not saying, like, as a person. I'm just saying, like, Eyes Wide Shut 1999, Eyes Wide Shut could not have been made in 2010.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
So, anyway, this has been this week's Stanley Kubrick Corner.
There we go. We should do it more often.
I did get some more Kubrick DVDs because there's some other ones I haven't caught up on, and I'm going to do it.
Good. Yeah. I'm excited. Yeah. Now you have convinced me I need to go back to Barry Lyndon.
Yeah.
It's been too long since I saw that movie.
I'm close enough to running out of his movies that I haven't seen that I think I'm just going to polish them off. Because, like, it's just, I've picked them off over the years, and I'm like, oh, God, I only have, like, this and this left.
Yeah.
A couple of, like, the very early ones, but those some of those
Yeah, like Paths of Glory.
Yeah. Yeah. That's Criterion has that now, so I'm going to get that. Yeah. Cool. Anyway. All right. Anything else, Sean, or should we move on to some news?
Let's move on to the news, Jonathan.
Speaking of Stanley Kubrick.
Okay, yeah.
They did fully detail and announce, since our last podcast, the new 2001 A Space Odyssey 50th Anniversary Blu-ray that's coming out. And I just wanted to say, to call it out, it's coming out October 30th. It does have the new 4K remaster they're doing on all versions, so you don't have to have a 4K Blu-ray player. The normal Blu-ray, which they are also issuing separately, so you don't have to buy both,
right,
will have the new master taken from the 70mm film elements. It really is supposed to look as much like the original version as possible, like what we saw in theaters with the new 70mm version.
Awesome.
As a whole disc of bonus features collecting everything they've had on that movie. Like I said, October 30th. The 4K Blu-ray is pretty pricey right now, but will probably come down. And then the normal one is only $20. Will probably also come down. But I just wanted to shout that out because that's a cool movie, and I only have a DVD of that, and I have never upgraded to the Blu-ray, and I'm glad I've waited because now I can get this one.
This sounds like the version to get, especially if they put all those special features on there. Because there's been some really cool behind-the-scenes stuff in like different special effects documentaries about that movie that have been made.
So I'm excited for that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Tom Holland revealed, going to new movies, Tom Holland, who plays Spider-Man in the Marvelverse.
Good old Spidey.
Revealed on Instagram, sort of accidentally on purpose, playing on the fact that Tom Holland cannot keep spoilers in.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
It looks like the title of the new Spider-Man movie, the third Spider-Man 2, is Spider-Man Far From Home. Which sort of sounds like a Spider-Man, like, after school special or something, but
it sounds like a Spider-Man graphic novel or like collection of like 8 issues of this story that's like Spider-Man Far From Home. I can see it.
Yes, everyone's speculating that like, oh, is this going to be like in the Netherverse he's entered at the end of Infinity? No, he's just probably going to be out of New York.
He's going to like take a train down to Pennsylvania and hang out in Pennsylvania.
Where would you like to see Tom Holland Spider-Man go traveling the world?
Oh, geez. That's a good, like, somewhere where there are no, like, he goes to the desert. No, nowhere, no buildings to swing on, nothing to Spider-Man with.
There are rumors that this one is, like, doing stuff in Europe. Like, he goes on, like, a class trip to Europe or something.
Yeah.
I think that would be fucking awesome, because it would be fun to have a Spider-Man action sequence on the Eiffel Tower.
What if they use this to Trojan horse Captain Britain into the Marvel Cinematic Universe? And you think that's a joke? That's not a joke.
I know that's not a joke. There's no superhero name too silly.
that's very true.
Who should play Captain Britain, Sean? They've already got Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch.
That's true. I mean, they could... Well, no, because the Martin Freeman character is supposed to be American, even though...
Yeah.
No. But I was going to say, like, they could just make it like that character turn into Captain Britain, but I don't think you could fully justify that. And yeah, you do have the two. You do have the two who you'd normally cast are already in.
Yeah, just trying to think of like the most British person they could get for that, but I don't know.
They just in Infinity War they killed off Idris Elba's Heimdall character. Just bring him back
as Captain Britain.
That'd be
pretty great.
That'd be a fucking really badass. That'd be a scary Captain Britain.
They've got a whole slew of Doctor Who's they could choose from.
It's true, yeah.
That's true. You know, Matt Smith has had a couple of franchises fall through.
Yeah.
His time on the crown is done. He could play a very weird-looking superhero.
Yeah, I could see that. And then you could have Tom Baker be, like, the old Captain Britain. And, like, he's, like, you know, he comes in.
Somehow we brought this back to Doctor Who.
Anyway, back to Doctor Who.
Glad to see this is not called Spider-Man Homecoming 2.
Yeah, that would have been weird.
Yes.
Like, Homecoming is just very stressful. Spider-Man every year comes around.
But Far From Home, I like the title. I do agree with you. It sounds like a graphic novel, which is cute. And we'll see. I still want to know how the hell they are going to market this movie, considering it's coming out a month after Infinity War 2, and we still don't know the fate of Spider-Man from Infinity War 1. So who knows?
He's dead. It's just it's about Aunt May and the supporting cast from the first movie.
They should make a fake Spider-Man 2 trailer where what happens is that like Aunt May discovers like Spidey's like her dead nephew's like old costume, and then like she gets bit by a spider and she becomes Spider-May.
Spider-May, and that must exist.
Yeah,
I think that might have happened in the Spider-Man, Spider-Verse stuff.
Yeah. So anyway. Yeah. But yeah, we're gonna, Spider-Man is going the way of Star Wars. We will have a Spider-Man movie every year from now on, apparently, because we had Homecoming last year, we've got Enter the Spider-Verse this year, we've got this one next year.
I'll take it.
I'll take it.
Spider-Man's time has come once more. We're getting these movies, we're getting the game, you know, there was a very dark time.
Yes. Roughly Spider-Man 3 to Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, it was a rough, and it's like, and it is something of where, like, I just look back on Spider-Man 3 so fondly now. This Amazing Spider-Man 2 is so much worse than any of the stuff in Spider-Man 3. This is like, oh, Spider-Man 3 is a good fucking, in the scale of Spider-Man movies,
yes,
Spider-Man 3 is among the better Spider-Man movies.
That is sadly true.
Yeah. We're at that point. But yeah, no, it's, because the one thing I have been doing, because you know I'm very excited about this Spider-Man game that's coming out. I've started rereading. I broke out my old Spider-Man comics. I've been reading some of those.
Did you read the one I gave you for the
I haven't gotten there yet. Okay. I think that's like issue 110 or something. Okay. I'm on like issue 22, I think. I read the annual, Spider-Man annual number 1 where the Sinister Six are introduced last night. It still holds up. They're very good.
Nice. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to some Star Wars news.
Okay, before we talk about Star Wars, we have to talk about the news of Star Wars.
This will make a very clean transition.
Have we had like 50 fucking weeks straight of just Star Wars news segments on this podcast? It feels like every week there's a new piece of Star Wars news.
Almost certainly, but yes. So reports surfaced this week from Collider and a couple of other places that the Star Wars spinoff films have all been shelved in the wake of Solo's somewhat disastrous box office reception. The Star Wars Story brand, which would include the Obi-Wan and Boba Fett films, are rumored to have been shelved in favor of focusing development on Episode 9, the Rian Johnson trilogy, the Benioff Weiss films, and trying to figure out what they do post-Episode 9, which I thought was going to be those things, but I guess that's separate.
I don't know what that even means. Yeah. I just don't even know what that means. Are they planning to release more than one Star Wars movie a year? Is that where they're heading?
Oh, almost certainly. I mean, we'll get into that in a second.
Okay.
So yeah. Lucasfilm has since, they have not come out officially and denied this, but they like leaked sources to another publication that said this isn't true. But reports of, in particular, Stephen Daldry leaving the Obi-Wan project have persisted. He was the guy who was going to be writing and directing the Obi-Wan film, which had never formally been announced, but we knew he was working on it. It had never even been formally announced that Ewan McGregor would be coming back for it. There's even a rumor now that it does not look like real to me, but that like Ewan McGregor is now going to be in Episode 9 as like a flashback thing or something, but I don't know. I don't actually think that's true.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, I'm guessing that the truth here is not as extreme as they have just canceled all this, but I also don't think it's as extreme in the other way of that, no, we're not changing our behavior at all after a Star Wars movie flopped for the first time in history.
Yeah, we weren't caught like deers in headlights.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
It is weird, though, because, I mean, the Boba Fett film absolutely should be canceled.
Yes, God, yes.
That has flop written all over it in 6 different colors. The Obi-Wan thing, like, there's no reason that couldn't be a hit.
Yeah.
Maybe don't release it a week after Avengers and a week before Incredibles 2 or something.
Maybe don't make it, like, more expensive than your, like, main episode movies also.
Right. Maybe hire directors who you think will be qualified to direct it and not reshoot the entire movie halfway through. Like, the Solo thing is such a weird special case that I feel like going in the other direction and canceling all Star Wars spinoffs would be a weird overreaction. But obviously they have to be thinking about this. And we already had this conversation with Solo of like, what's their reaction to this going to be? Because we liked that movie, actually,
in general.
But, you know, clearly it did not work commercially. There has been very little conversation about it since it came out. I'll say I have not really thought about it much since it came out. Nope, it kind of came and went.
The most I've thought about Solo since I saw Solo was last night when I was watching Empire Strikes Back. You're like, oh, right, Solo.
Yeah, sadly for me too. So, I don't know. It does feel like obviously they should be reorienting some things. And it sounds like they probably are going to. If nothing else, if Solo killed the Boba Fett movie, I'm okay with that.
But my only problem with it is spoilers for the stupidest thing in Solo Star Wars Story. They brought Darth Maul back.
Right.
And my pet theory is and continues to be that they brought Darth Maul back in that movie to then have him fight Boba Fett in the Boba Fett movie, because there's no more stupid fucking, like, Star Wars fan winking bullshit you could do than that. And I so want that to happen just for how bad it would be.
You're probably right. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that the Boba Fett thing was leaked to the press like a week before Solo came out. That probably was part of it. They wanted to get everyone excited. But yeah, I don't know. The bigger thing here, I think, is that there have been some pretty clear lessons that Star Wars is not Marvel. It is not something you can just have every year and have it get bigger and bigger.
Or if it is, you have to handle it in a very different way.
Right. And there are no indications they're going in a radically different direction. It's just, it sounds like they're cutting the stupidest ideas off, you know? So, I don't know. This is kind of like non-news news. It is interesting that that's already percolating, because these were like sources within Lucasfilm who reached out to the press. So, you know, maybe there's some disgruntled people there or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm very curious what the future of Star Wars is going to be. They've got to get Episode 9 right, and then we'll see what else is coming of it. I assumed the Rian Johnson trilogy thing was what their next, like, series was going to be.
Yeah, even if it wouldn't be called Episodes 10 to 12, it would just be, like, basically that.
Because you can't jump into Episode 10 2 years after Episode 9.
No.
That would be stupid in so many fucking ways. So I just assumed, like, that would be the next chapter of the saga, but they wouldn't be Star Wars episodes.
Yeah.
And then maybe they would do some other stuff on the side. But it sounds like their idea is that that's still side stuff, and they're just going to make episodes forever, is the other part of this rumor.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if to be clear, I don't know if I believe that. I do think there are probably legitimate discussions going on of, if Episode 9 is the end of this so-called trilogy, do we want to be done with, you know, Poe, Finn, Rey, all those characters? You know, are there other things we can do with them? Which, my view is, after The Last Jedi, it does not feel like we only have one film left in this story.
No.
At all. So, I don't know. My kind of heart goes out to everyone making Episode 9, because I don't know how you do that.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll see.
I feel like Episode 9 is going to come out, and then, like, humanity goes extinct. Like, that's how the history of mankind works, right? Like, it's just the fucking nerd fury of, no matter even what the movie is, it doesn't matter at this point what's in Episode 9. People are going to be fucking pissed about it.
Yeah.
And people are going to be pissed about people being pissed about it.
I mean,
people are going to be pissed about people being pissed about being pissed about it, and like so on down the chain until we're all dead.
I mean, that is also one of the bigger parts of this discussion, too, is that, is Star Wars fandom so self-destructive that the franchise cannot survive because of the people who watch it? Which I think is an open question.
Yeah.
Because the other news this week in Star Wars Dome was the group of fans who are trying to raise $200 million to make their own remake of The Last Jedi, because they're that fucking pathetic and stupid.
But, like, but then that's, like, another, like, brick in the wall that is going to crush us. That's a bad metaphor. But that, because it's some fucking stupid idiot fucking put that out, and it's fucking dumb. But then the only reason I ever even heard about it was because there's 500 film critics that retweet that and, like, comment on it immediately. It's like, why even? Like, why even give it the dignity of even acknowledging that some asshole said that on Twitter?
Well, because that's what I'm saying. This is also why, when we were talking about why Kubrick would not survive in the 2000s, is because we amplify the stupidest voices among us. In the past, like, I'm sure there was some fan who hated The Empire Strikes Back and was it is bullshit that Darth Vader's Luke's dad. I'm going to remake the movie on
my own.
And
to be clear, it's not necessarily wrong in that moment to be like, that's fucking bullshit. That was not true. That was not set up in the first movie, because it wasn't.
But, like, let's say, but here's the thing. You would never hear about that person.
Yeah.
Ever. They would not get a voice, they would not get a platform, and rightfully fucking so. But now, and you see this in politics, you see this in entertainment, we amplify the stupidest voices, and it's part of the thing that is crushing Star Wars in on itself, is that the movies can't just be the fucking movies. It has to be people talking about them in the dumbest ways possible. And I hope we avoid that on this show, but I don't know.
Yeah.
We're at least talking about the movies critically, and hopefully substantively.
Yeah.
But even we're talking about this now, so I don't know. Star Wars is in a weird place. Sean, why don't we just go back and talk about maybe the brightest moment in Star Wars history?
What I think is still the best Star Wars movie, for sure.
The Empire Strikes Back.
The Star Wars Episode 5, the sequel to Star Wars.
It's got the best title.
Yes.
The Empire Strikes Back is the best Star Wars title.
Yeah.
It's so good. I've always loved that. It always makes me think of like my VHS case where it would say in giant letters, "The Empire Strikes Back." That's something we've kind of lost in modern Star Wars releases, is they always want to emphasize the word Star Wars and sometimes the episode number. And I'm like, no, the title is so cool. Put that big on the box, "The Empire Strikes Back," because it's such a great... Because that's also what the movie is about. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, the thing to talk about with The Empire Strikes Back. This is one of, if not the most famous film sequels of all time. It is one of, if not the most influential sequels of all time. It has been... The bones of this movie have been copied and built on to death in the last 40 years of pop culture. And part of it is that basic idea of, in the first movie, you had a very closed-ended narrative where the heroes got together, they fought the bad guys, they won, and they flew off into the sunset. And then in this one, the Empire's like, not so fast! We're gonna smack you motherfuckers down!
We're the Galactic Empire?
Yes.
You might have heard of us.
And that was, in part, the revelation of this movie, and it still reverberates, is that, again, that not so fast, we're gonna go chase you fuckers off Hoth, and then the rest of the movie is you guys flailing to try to get a foothold as we rain hell down upon you.
Yep.
And I was struck this time by, like, just how confidently Empire Strikes Back starts off on that foot and moves through the rest of the movie, and especially if you can try to put yourself in the shoes of, like, people watching this when it came out, or when you saw it for the first time, and just kind of strip away the layers of, like, the parodies we've seen, and the amount of times you've seen it, and talked about this movie, and just be with the emotions of the film, it still works like gangbusters.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing movie in a lot of ways. Just the structure of the, like, sort of the three-pronged structure of Luke, Han / Leia, and then the best part, Darth Vader. Darth Vader's so fucking good in this movie. But yeah, and like it sort of cutting between those three bits like very rhythmically throughout the whole film until those different subplots start colliding in different configurations at the end. And then yeah, like just having the utter balls to end this movie on a complete utter cliffhanger, but still finds a way to feel like the message of the movie has wrapped up and like the major character arcs have come to their conclusion. The characters are in a very different place at the end of the movie than they were at the beginning. And particularly Luke has gone on this, like, journey that has brought him very low, but feels like he's coming back up again. He has accomplished the task he needed to go to improve his character and go further in the future.
Yeah, I mean, Empire Strikes Back ends on a cliffhanger, but I never think about it that way. It tells a complete story.
Yeah.
If there was no more Star Wars after this, that would be infuriating and sad.
Yeah.
But also, the story of The Empire Strikes Back is the story of them falling to the point they fall to. Mm-hmm. And that is the end of this story. And it just so happens that that coincides with what we would consider narratively a cliffhanger, and that we want to know the fates of several characters. But that is the end of this story. Like, Han's arc is going into that good night gracefully, you know, and the "I love you, I know." That is his arc, and it ends with him in a low carbonite frozen place, but that's where he has to go in this story. And as you say, having the balls and the follow through to do all of that, this is just one of the most confident, accomplished Hollywood movies, let alone sequels, of all time.
Yeah.
So let's back out a second.
Okay.
Let's talk about the meta for a second. I'm curious, what version did you watch?
The despecialized edition like I did with Star Wars.
I did too. And I actually do want to start there for a second.
Okay, yeah.
Because this is one where the special edition talk is like less relevant than it is for Star Wars or Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, there are no like big scenes or sequences that are altered like the like or added like the Jabba thing from Star Wars or the weird
or the mountains Jabba of palace. Shit in Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi.
Yeah. So I had I actually watched the normal Blu-ray for A New Hope for what I think it was because the night I was watching it I had to watch it with headphones and my player that I would play the despecialized version out of wouldn't do that, so I had to watch it on a Blu-ray on a different player. Anyway, that's how that came out. We were on a tight schedule.
Yeah.
But this one time, I had the pleasure of watching the despecialized edition. I've seen the despecialized edition of Star Wars. I have not seen it of Empire before. It's really good. Yeah. I wanted to start there and recommend this. This is the Harmy despecialized edition. That's the guy who did it. And it's, I've seen the theatrical cuts of these movies many times, but they've never been available in below standard def quality, obviously. Yeah. And this is an, HD reconstruction restoration using a bunch of different types of footage to put it together. And I was impressed because Empire Strikes Back has very few, of those annoying special edition changes, although there's a couple I want to talk about. But it has on DVD and Blu-ray been treated super poorly in terms of the restoration and color timing. And I did notice that this time. Empire Strikes Back has probably the most striking cinematography of the franchise.
Yeah.
At least until The Last Jedi. And I've never seen it look so good as on this. Like, the despecialized edition is uneven because they have to use different sources, and it's not as good looking as, like, a, you know, perfectly mastered Blu-ray. But there are a bunch of points where he's done a ton of color correcting to make the movie look better. I'm specifically thinking of all the stuff in the third act in Cloud City where you're in, like, the depths where the carbonite chamber is,
yeah,
and where Luke and Vader are fighting. On DVD and Blu-ray, those scenes have always been pushed so hard towards the blues that all the red in the color becomes orange, and Vader's lightsaber just becomes straight up pink. I remember that on the 2004 DVD. It's not as bad on the Blu-ray, but it becomes super pink. And I just remember from, like, the VHS that looked wrong. But seeing it now in HD, where what he's done is he's restored the proper contrast, where that scene relies on this really stark split between a very deep blue on the top of the frame and a very deep red on the bottom. Like, there is literally, like, the two lightsabers are reflected in the production design.
Yeah.
I've never seen that represented so well. And honestly, those scenes played better to me than they have since I was a little kid, in part because you got to see the full visual language Irvin Kershner was working with. And that's one of the things I love. But yeah, so just getting to see the theatrical version of Empire in really good quality was an absolute treat for me.
Yeah, this is definitely the best version of it I've seen. Because
yes.
I've seen the theatrical edition in potato quality before. And
yes.
It's cool. And then the special edition. But yes, the not having the pink Darth Vader lightsaber and having that, because it's not just like that scene, it is something I noticed more throughout also, of just like the like blue red contrast
yes.
is very distinct throughout most of the movie, and there's a lot of like Dagobah has a lot of blue, and then like getting like some of those like deeper reds from the different kind of like lights and electronics that Luke brings, like that is a recurring visual motif that stands out much better in this version of the movie.
There's a lot more detail on Hoth I'd never noticed because
yeah.
the DVD just pushes it so blue it all kind of gets muddled together because Hoth is a blue tinged sequence.
Yeah.
But that's the color scheme. It's not necessarily the color timing. Like, and this has always struck me as gross how much George Lucas fiddled with this one because it's not, he didn't direct this one.
Right.
And I know it is still his thing as a producer, but like, I always have felt like anything he did to this, Irvin Kershner should have been able to sign off on, and he didn't, especially because George Lucas made changes after Kershner died, which I think is really fucking gross. But yeah. No, the cinematography in this movie is so good, and like, compositionally, I've always known that, but in terms of how it uses color, I've never gotten to appreciate it the
yeah.
way it does here. And there were two changes I wanted to mention, because I forgot one of these was in here. In the original theatrical version, after Vader and Luke fight, and Vader cuts off his hand and Luke jumps off, Vader goes back up to Cloud City and he says very curtly, he says, "Bring my shuttle." And Thomas and I both kind of like, we were watching this together, my brother and I, kind of gasped at that moment of like, there is so much emotion in how James Earl Jones reads that line, of that you can read into that so many different things about Vader being angry, frustrated, but also, I think, kind of like sad that this didn't go his way.
Yeah, that, I mean, he just, as far as he knows, just watched his son plunge to his death.
Yes.
Where especially if you incorporate the prequels into that, you then have like, oh, fuck, like,
right.
That was my son, the son of Padme, who died tragically, that the whole reason I fell to the dark side, and the Emperor is a lying piece of shit, and like, there's a lot, if you read into that, there's a lot go through Vader's head.
Yes.
In that fucking moment.
And in the special edition, that is changed to, in that, and it's a small clip, they don't change the duration of the clip, but they redub James Earl Jones saying, like 30 years later, because it was not recorded with the original movie, "Alert the Star Destroyer to prepare for my arrival imminently," or something. Like, it's a really long line. He has to rush through it. There's no emotion in it. That is maybe the most bizarre special edition change to me. Why? Why do you do that?
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten, because I even said to Thomas, "I think that's not in the special edition." He's like, "It's not?" And we pulled out the Blu-ray and checked. And I'm like, yeah, that's... And it doesn't even sound good in the mix, because it's not... They had to layer it on top. So that's a weird one.
Yeah, that is weird.
The other one that I do want to talk about is the change with the scene with the Emperor.
Right, yes.
So in the theatrical cut, it's not Ian McDiarmid because they had not... the Emperor is not a character yet in Empire
yeah.
Strikes Back. So I think in theory, this change made total sense. Where on the 2004 DVD, they did this while they were shooting Revenge of the Sith. They had Ian McDiarmid come back and redo that scene where Vader and the Emperor talk, and now it's the Emperor we all know and love from episode 6 and then 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Works in theory. In practice, they also change a bunch of the dialogue, and yeah. I don't think the scene flows as well. Mm-hmm. Because what it is, in the original version, it's a very sparse scene, and the Emperor makes a reference to the son of Skywalker, you know, is very powerful with the Force. And you can tell there's some unspoken thing going on between Vader and the Emperor here, but it's not clear what it is. It's very clearly foreshadowing for the end of the movie.
Yeah.
But in the special edition cut with Ian McDiarmid, they change it to, we've discovered that this is the son of Anakin Skywalker. And Vader's like, what you talking about? And then the Emperor's like, search your feelings. You know it to be true. Wink. And then he does it. And so the implication becomes Vader is only finding out in this moment Luke is his son. And the scene is not built for us to process it that way.
And that also doesn't really make sense when the opening crawl of Empire Strikes Back specifically points out that Vader has been desperately searching for Luke Skywalker.
Yes. Like, I think if you watch the theatrical cut of this movie, Vader has a... It's opaque the first time you see it, but if you know going in, you know, Vader is Luke's father, which you probably do.
Yeah, it'd be very hard to watch the movie not knowing that.
It's there in all of his motivations.
Yes.
Like, Vader is very well characterized in this movie, as you were alluding to earlier. So, yeah, I like, in theory, having Ian McDiarmid there. In practice, theatrical cut 100% all the way. It's so much better.
Yeah, it's definitely better. And it's a shame, because I would like to have... Ian McDiarmid just using the original dialogue would be obviously like the best of both worlds, but that version doesn't exist.
Yeah, George, that's the thing about the special editions, is even when George Lucas, I think, had good ideas and intentions, he took it so too far in every case. I'm just so glad these despecialized editions exist now, because I don't think Disney's giving us proper restorations.
No, all the people who thought that when Star Wars was signed over to Disney, that would be like, oh, the fans have won. No. The fans never win because the fans are not a real thing, and then the corporations are not going to give you what you want.
The fans who put together these versions are the real thing.
Yes.
Because that is Herculean work that normally requires a team of paid experts. So, anyway. Just wanted to shout that out, too, because I think most of the time when people talk about the special editions, they focus on Return of the Jedi and A New Hope. And definitely, like, Return of the Jedi gets... ass fucked by special editions. It is horrible. Except one change at the end I kind of like.
Yeah.
But Empire Strikes Back, still I think the theatrical cut, like, because this was already pretty much a perfect movie. When you mess with a perfect movie, it's not perfect anymore.
Yeah.
So you should watch the theatrical cut and go pirate the shit out of it.
Yeah, I mean, do you own versions of this movie?
Yes.
If you've given the blood money,
yeah,
get the good version of the movie.
Yes. Also pirate the shit out of it, because they've never actually delivered the version that they should on home video.
Yeah.
So just despite them. Anyway, but now that we've talked about the meta stuff of it, so that's the version we watched. So Sean, we've been going through all of these, you know, in order, 1, 2, 3, well, in this particular order, 1, 2, 3, 4, now we're at 5. We're almost done, which is kind of sad. But what struck you the most about Empire Strikes Back this time in the context we're watching it? Where do you kind of want to start this discussion?
There's a couple of things, and we kind of touched on it, of like the despecialized editions, that quality of it struck me a lot, and I noticed the same things you noticed about the coloring. One thing I sort of like felt this time, it like related to what I talked about when we were talking about Star Wars / A New Hope, is that movie, when I watch it, particularly like having watched with the despecialized editions, feels like it's not quite a Star Wars movie, because Star Wars is not quite Star Wars yet, and it's that weird shit of like, you know, Darth Vader is not Luke's dad in that movie. It's just not possible. Like, Leia and Luke are obviously not siblings. They're still not quite siblings in this movie, clearly. And
given the passionate mouth-to-mouth kiss.
Yeah. And that kind of stuff. But there is, like... But contrast with that, Empire Strikes Back, watching this, when I watch it, it just feels like, oh, this is the first Star Wars movie. This is the movie where Star Wars becomes Star Wars. This is the movie where so much about... what we associate with Star Wars on, like, I think on a slightly deeper level than the sort of like the aesthetics of everything of the original movie, we still associate very much with Star Wars. But some of the original, like, I don't know, like, kind of dramatic material is not quite fully there of like what we associate with Star Wars now. And it is that, like, the more of the melodrama that Empire Strikes Back brings to it, of having the romance between Han and Leia, and then having the, like, intense you know, like what is basically like classical Victorian melodrama in many ways of I am your father, you know, like that element of it brings out this very sort of like, I don't know, personal quality to the movie that's not quite a part of the, like, this is not a criticism of A New Hope, but it's not a fabric of, it's not a part of what the fabric of that movie is all the way. Whereas, like, here, it very much is, like, steeped in that, and that is so much of what Star Wars becomes, and later Star Wars movies and the prequels have a lot of that melodrama in there. Obviously, like, Anakin is a very melodramatic character in the prequels. And then also just, like, all the spin-off materials of, like, Knights of the Old Republic draws so much from that framework. The new movies draw a lot from that framework. And that's so much of, like, what I associate with Star Wars is a part of that emotional texture that this movie, like, dives really deep into.
It definitely feels like this one takes all the raw material from the first film and locks it into the shape that we recognize as Star Wars, yeah. Right? And in addition, not just, like, I agree with everything you said, a lot of, like, how it handles story and character development, and I also think specifically how it pitches tone, like, mm-hmm. It has really pinpointed in a way that is not that far from what A New Hope is, but is far enough that it feels more like it's its own tone and it's really developed it. But there's also just all these in-universe things where it feels like Empire Strikes Back is kind of the Rosetta Stone of the franchise, like, everything I think we popularly conceive the Force to be Yes. Is established in Empire Strikes Back.
Absolutely, yeah. In Star Wars A New Hope, it is a very vague concept, and here Yoda gives... It's still, like, vague because you can't explain this weird metaphysical bullshit in 5 minutes or whatever.
Right.
But it is given a much clearer identity in this film.
Well, and even I think just the way the Force operates through characters in the thematic framework Yoda presents to us, mm-hmm. like... He has the line about, you know, like Luke says, is the dark side stronger? And Yoda says, no, but faster, quicker it is.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what you see is that Luke is being pulled by the dark side of the Force because he gets too brash. And what Darth Vader is offering him is this very stark but powerful difference. And so I just think there are so many things like that of what our popular conception of Star Wars is lies in Empire Strikes Back. Also on a bunch of aesthetic things. Like,
yeah.
I think the way this movie plays with, you know, big, bold colors in its cinematography, the way it takes us to all these fantastic places, which A New Hope does a tiny bit of, but that's not really what that movie's about. It's Tatooine, the Death Star, space. You know,
there's a little bit of Yavin, like, rebel base.
Yes. But this one has all of that, and I also think musically, like, not that there's anything wrong with John Williams' original Star Wars score, but when you hear the Imperial March come in full force, you're like, now it's Star Wars.
Yeah.
To some degree, like, it's easy to forget that that is not in A New Hope. Because uh-huh. I actually think in the special edition they went and put it in.
They might have, yeah.
Yeah, they fucked it and put it in there anyway. But yes, like, there's just something that, like, and I actually think probably A New Hope has a better score overall, although the Empire score is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
But, like, just how John Williams also starts to lock in pieces of musical identity here. Yeah, I mean, Empire Strikes Back... You're so right in terms of this feeling like, in some ways, the birth of what we know as Star Wars.
Yeah. But then also, like, getting to some of that, like, Star Wars, or whatever, like, what you identify with it is the lightsaber fight at the end of A New Hope is terrible.
Right.
It's just, like, awful. And it's something that, like, when I watched A New Hope in that framework of, like, what if this was the only Star Wars movie, which is a very easy possibility in, like, the history of us, of, like, cinema, that was it, that they never made a sequel, right? And it's, like, how just utterly underutilized the lightsaber concept is in that film, that it's, like, it's used, like, twice, and the one fight you get is very nothing. It's between a big, like, stiff robot guy and an old man.
Yes.
But the lightsaber fight in Empire Strikes Back is one of the best.
Oh, absolutely.
It's so good. And the way that Darth Vader is just fucking with Luke and a lot of it comes to that, like, color contrast in the framing and the pacing of it and, like, the deep, deep black of, like, just the whole environment with the blue smoke and then the red floor and them, you know, and there's just, like, those little things of, like, Luke kind of stepping forward a bit and Darth Vader, like, not cowering away, but stepping back, and, like, Darth Vader's clearly, you know, a more practiced swordsman. All those kinds of, like, little elements of what makes the lightsaber fight at the end of this movie is so much more wholly realized and gives you a better picture of, like, assuming that stuff like the prequels and Clone Wars don't exist, where you get a much better picture of, like, what the Jedi were as an organization. Empire Strikes Back, and that sequence in particular, gives you a hint of what the Jedi were and what a Jedi Knight might be. And that, like, that part of the mythology, like, locks into place for me in that sequence in a way it is so, like, vague and kind of vaporous or something in the first movie.
Oh, absolutely. Because the visual language of what a lightsaber fight is and how you choreograph it and put it together, that is Irvin Kershner, Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
And every lightsaber fight since has pulled from this. It has not pulled from A New Hope.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, we'll never know exactly the split in contributions between Kershner, Lucas, all these people. We'll talk about the different players, because it's really interesting with this one. Because this is the first Star Wars movie we've talked about yet, actually, that is not George Lucas directed.
Right.
Because in this order, weirdly, this is the one where it switches. But yes. But yeah, like, just as you were talking about, like, the way, like, one of the things I noticed is that there are all these interesting moves where, like, so much character is put into it, but also the way Kershner shoots it is in these long takes where you tend to go unbroken between a series of parries and moves, and you cut when, like, a change in the movements happen, like, the action takes place. Whereas, you know, you're not cutting, like, between flurries or anything like that. And the way you kind of shoot it almost like a dance with, like, full bodies in the frame. All these things, like, that's all the building blocks of, like, the Duel of the Fates in Episode 1. That has more fancy choreography, and I think more time and work was probably put into it. But is it the same foundationally? Absolutely. And so, yes, there are all those different things that just The Empire Strikes Back, as you're saying, is, like, kind of Star Wars 101 stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like, you know, thank God we got Empire and it's as good as it is, because it is weird to think of a world where, like, the first movie is actually the template for all that kind of stuff, when it is, like, again, the first movie is fucking amazing, but right. It is, those sorts of things are not fully solidified yet.
Yeah, I mean, the first movie is amazing, but it is this weird thing where it does kind of feel like it stands enough apart from the rest of the franchise that you can imagine the two, like, diverging timelines where either it becomes Star Wars, the biggest franchise in the world, or it became Star Wars, that little cult classic that your friend showed you on VHS and was an interesting curio.
Yeah.
You know? Which there are a million of in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
Because those were the decades of, like, cheap, chintzy sci-fi and fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Which, Star Wars is not necessarily cheap or chintzy, but it is cheap and chintzy adjacent.
Yes,
that first movie is held together with scotch tape and prayer. As
yes,
said.
You know, they like are pulling costumes from other movies outside of the lot and being like, let's just throw this into that cantina scene, you know?
Yes. Well, with that in mind, that's actually an interesting thing to talk about. Empire Strikes Back is that I do think this movie is, like, I love the original Star Wars. I love that it is so much, it feels like a labor of love, of, like, people kind of working by the seat of their pants to see if they can pull this crazy thing off. And there is a very particular, you know, irreplaceable charm to that. What The Empire Strikes Back replaces it with is fucking confidence.
Yeah.
Which is, like, this movie from moment one just moves with an assuredness of step that the first one very naturally does not have, because it was the first one of these. But this movie feels like it knows what it is doing, how to do it. There are a couple of awkward effects shots here and there, but not nearly as many as you get in the first movie.
No.
It really feels all the more immersive and complete. You also kind of, I think, feel a little bit of the just cinematic transition from the 70s to the 80s going on in this movie. I will say, though, like, with all that, just a brief aside, I did notice it took about a half hour of watching Empire Strikes Back for me to adjust out of the last sci-fi movie I saw was 2001.
Yeah.
And for about half an hour, I'm like, man, Empire Strikes Back looks really cheap. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. It actually looks amazing. It looks cheap in comparison to 2001.
Yeah.
Which most movies do. It is amazing to think that this is 12 years after 2001. And that is just how large a shadow that casts, is that the model work still is not as good as 2000.
Yeah. Although, but it is, like, you have some of those early Star Destroyer shots. I had, like, the same effect you had of, like, oh, God, I have to kind of put 2001 aside, because it's both, like, you know, yes, like, the model work is never going to be as good. And then also, I'm obviously not watching it on a 70mm print in, like, a nice theater with a good projection and everything.
But that's a good thing. Because the theatrical cuts have never gotten a proper film restoration, and frankly, the special editions haven't either. Like, a good go-to-the-negative, do-a-full restoration, that's never happened to Star Wars. I don't know how this could look if it was done like perfectly, because I know there's a lot of things that are more the effect of like degradation in the image than clarity. But yeah, as we have it, you're right. Yeah, exactly what you were saying.
Yeah. But also like just the way that they shoot the models and like the Star Destroyers in particular are like, that's just 2001. Like you're just trying to do the 2001 with these shots.
Well, I'll tell you though, the shot that kind of drove this all out of my mind, and I was in Star Wars mode, is there is one of my favorite effect shots in all of Star Wars is when you watch these, when Han is trying to escape in the Millennium Falcon, and they've like hid on one of the Star Destroyers, and then they're leaving.
Yes.
And the two pass over each other in space, and it's like a low angle space shot up on the two passing Star Destroyers.
Yeah, and they're like, there's three of them, I think, because they all like kind of intersect, but since you're seeing like a flat image, yes, it's good.
That's one of those moments where it's like, they never had that much artistry in the first film in terms of how they shot effects. This is like, that is a very much a cinematographer's eye of shooting an effects thing, which is very much a 2001 thing, but I find that interesting.
Yeah, that's great. The thing in the effects that made me very happy, because I think it looks particularly good in this version of the movie, is all the stop motion stuff on Hoth is so fucking good. The AT-ATs in particular is some of the best stop motion that's ever been done.
Yes. And
it's unbelievably good. Like, there are shots where you can't even tell.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. And the shots where you can tell, I love being able to tell because it is so, like, all the Tauntaun stuff is very Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah.
But it looks great. I think on the special edition, they do a lot to, like, try to, like, smooth that over, and I don't like that. Like, because stop motion effects are fucking cool.
They're so good, yeah.
And yeah, like, that's the thing. There are some shots where you can tell the AT-ATs are miniatures moving stop motion.
Yeah, it's mostly when they, like, fall over. You can definitely see the gaps in the motion.
But it's amazing how much you can't tell that in all these different places where it just feels like you are in the midst of this action. Like, that opening action sequence on Hoth is next level, out of this world, incredible stuff. Like, it is... It's definitely the best ground-based action scene in Star Wars.
Yeah, and like the best like sort of big war scene. Yeah. Like there's a reason why every fucking Star Wars video game that can do it has like done the Hoth thing, you know? It's like, it's when they made the new Battlefront games, they showed off the Hoth thing first. When they made the old Battlefront games, they showed the Hoth thing first. When they made the fucking Shadow of the Empire game on the N64, it was the Hoth thing. It's like, it is very iconic for a reason.
Well, and I was gonna, you know, I was thinking, man, I've seen the Hoth thing so many times. I've played it so many times. Like, Hoth has been done to death. Every time I go back to watch the movie, I think it's going to be kind of dull this time. And it's still better than any of that stuff.
It's so good.
Because just the confidence with which it is shot, the way it builds up to it, and that you have these first couple scenes where you have the adventure with Luke being lost out in the snow and Han having to go get him. And all the while, you know the Empire is coming. And then it's like, oh shit, it's go time, we're gonna fight the Empire, and it's such a great way to like contrast where we were at the end of the last movie. Of the end of the last movie is this fight that they barely eke out against the Death Star in space, so now let's take it to the ground and deliver basically our big action sequence for the movie at the start of the film, because the end is an action sequence, but it's not a big ensemble one like this. It's a one-on-one lightsaber fight, and it's almost more of a thriller scene in a lot of ways. So they do it here, and it is definitely an echo of what we got in A New Hope, but it is so different, it does not feel repetitive at all. And yeah, just the general, when you start to realize like what they're doing to the AT-ATs, like in the back of your mind, you've seen Empire before, you know what they're going to do to them.
Yeah.
But like, watch the sequence, like looking at how they're going to dole the information out to you, and it's like, oh, that's cool. That's fucking cool. They're just going to like tie their legs together and make them fall over.
Yeah. And in that sequence, I always particularly love the random dude who is Luke's like sort of like two-man or whatever, like in the back that's supposed to be on the harpoon that gets killed like a minute after you're introduced to it. They have like two lines of dialogue together. It's like, hey, Luke, how's it going? It's like, let's do it, buddy. Let's do this. Hey, are you? Oh, you're dead.
Yeah.
It's good.
What do you think of... There's a line in the opening crawl, I was just thinking about this, where it says, a group of freedom fighters led by Luke Skywalker have established a base on Hoth, and I'm like, in no way are they led by Luke Skywalker.
Not even close. They're basically led by Leia and, like, the general dude whose name I forget at the beginning of the movie. Yeah, they're not led by Luke Skywalker. But he's good to put on the poster, you know?
He is. I do like that the sequel trilogy made good mention of General Leia Organa in both opening scrolls.
Yeah.
To, like, put her back in her place. Like, she was always leading the Rebels. And it's like the crawl should have mentioned that somewhere in the original trilogy. Because, yeah, I mean, that's something to talk about here, is how well they position our three main characters at the start of this movie.
Yeah.
Because that is also something because this movie has three pretty clearly delineated acts. It has Hoth, it has the big middle where you have three separate stories.
The asteroid / Dagobah, basically.
Right. Yeah, and then the third act is Cloud City.
Yeah.
Right? And so, like, they're delineated by location, by sort of tone, by sort of the ups and downs of that. Middle section is fairly slow and serene, relatively. There's a little bit of action, but that's not the main focus of it. Serene's the wrong word, but maybe thoughtful, contemplative. Yeah. It's where, like, characters are kind of considering themselves, and then we're back into action for the last third. But what that first third does on Hoth of putting every character into a place where you feel that time has passed, the effects of the last movie had an effect on these characters. They are different than when we last saw them, but they also very clearly establish what those characters are going to be going through for the rest of this film and tease up these big character arcs.
Yeah.
And it's something I want to talk about in general is, like, people like to compare sequels to The Empire Strikes Back all the time. And that's not a bad instinct to have, because a lot of sequels borrow from Empire Strikes Back. But I think people are sometimes too unspecific when they talk about, like, imprecise when they talk about this. Because generally people just say, if a sequel is darker than the last movie, it's like The Empire Strikes Back.
Right, yeah. It's the obsession with the dark middle chapter concept. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not, to me, what makes Empire Strikes Back special. It's adjacent to that. But what makes Empire Strikes Back special is that it does not try to repeat the formula of the first movie, which this one in no way attempts to do the formula of Star Wars 1.
It's not structurally like the first movie. It's not dealing with the same thematic material as the first movie, no.
No, so it's got to be different than that, and it has to put the characters in places and on journeys that is going to deeply, existentially challenge them, and however they rise or fall to that occasion will leave a lasting impact at the end. That, to me, is the legacy of The Empire Strikes Back. And definitely, the history of Hollywood sequels is scattered with those. Like, Spider-Man 2 is an example of one that I would structurally not call much like Empire Strikes Back at all. I would not call it tonally much like it at all. But do I think it takes those basic tenets of what a sequel should be? Yes. And I think it's a lot more Empire Strikes Back-esque than The Dark Knight or something that people would compare to. The Dark Knight has nothing in comparison to the Empire. It is darker, yes, but, like, that's not really how it builds itself. That's not a bad thing. It's just different. But, you know, other ones I was thinking of in recent years, Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Heavily borrows this structure. It even does the triumvirate, like, storytelling thing. How to Train Your Dragon 2 from a couple years ago really borrows this. I mean, there's a ton. Are there any other off the top of your head?
I can't think of it. I mean, the one thing I was thinking of another thing that I like that I think is, I haven't seen How to Train Your Dragon 2, so I can't speak to that one, but the other ones that have in common that is something I don't think is strictly necessary, but I tend to very much like in movie sequels with characters like this is having that time pass and feeling that time has passed.
How to Train Your Dragon 2 does that hugely, actually.
Okay, yeah. Because it is one of the things that is a little bit frustrating about Star Wars The Last Jedi, even though that is, like, kind of, it is set up in such a way that it's very hard. I think it'd be very difficult to make The Last Jedi and not do that based on the ending of The Force Awakens. But it's one of those things of when you have that time that has passed between the two movies and you feel it, and Empire Strikes Back, that opening act is so well structured and the dialogue is very sharply written to give you little bits of hints of adventures they've had, they've gone on, like, and their relationships have kind of, like, shifted in different ways, and you see that between Han, Leia, and Luke, and you get those little hints of, like, okay, and this is where they're going to go, and this is, like, Han and Leia are gonna, you know, they have their kind of romance subplot, and Luke is, like, sort of teeing up to go to Dagobah and pursue the Jedi thing that he has clearly progressed on, you know, so, like, one of the first things we see Luke do is pull the lightsaber with the Force, which is something that had not happened yet. You have to put yourself in a mind space that is not something the Force can do. As far as you know, the Force allows you to like, say words at people, and then they repeat the words and let you go through checkpoints, and then you can talk to people from beyond the dead. You can shoot proton torpedoes really fucking well. And you can block little secret drone thingies with your eyes closed. Right. Like, that's all the Force stuff that we've seen. So we get that sense of Luke has progressed a lot. Han is so much more, like, noble and nice a person. He's still an asshole, but he is, like, committed to the Rebellion. He's stuck with the Rebellion for several years at this point.
He's decided to lean into the good parts of himself. Like,
yes.
It's, and again, this is why I say the character arc in the Solo movie is so smart, because what it is about is that the Han Solo persona tries to tamp down the goodness inherent in Han Solo. And The Empire Strikes Back is all about him not letting that be tamped down anymore.
Yeah.
He's just like, I'm going to be me, and me is a dick sometimes, but a good person.
Yeah, and they signal that so well when in that conversation, particularly the conversation he has with the Rebel General near the beginning, when he goes up to him and says, like, hey man, I'm sorry, I hate to do this, but I've got to go. And it's like, and it's basically like Han quitting a job is like, yeah, that's like what the scene is.
He should have brought a letter. He's, yeah, like, I've got this. You can read it if you want. I didn't seal it, but let me give you the lowdown.
And yeah, and like kind of explains this, like, oh, I got to pay off my debt to Jabba. And the Rebel General is like, oh, I hate to see a good guy like you go, but, you know,
Godspeed, man.
Yeah. But you know, like, yeah, a death mark on your head is a hard thing to live with. Like, I hope God go with you. I, you know, good luck and everything. And it's like, that is the Han Solo from the last movie would not have had that conversation. Like yeah, that would, like, it would have been like, you fucking piece of shit, you're going to run out on us again. Like, that would have been the way that it would have, the general would have reacted. Instead of, you clearly get the sense of how much he's contributed, how committed he has been to the Rebellion and all that. And
that, then his reason for going is pretty well supported, yeah, of like, I think I'm going to endanger you guys or something.
And yeah, I don't want fucking assassins on my head, so I'm going to go pay my debts off to Jabba. And that space between the two movies does so much to make it so much more sort of mythical and larger than life. And that is something that I think is a really smart thing to do for a series like Star Wars in particular. And it's one of those things of when you get to the sequel trilogy, I think one of the reasons why the world building feels lackluster to me is that, like, everything we saw in that sequel trilogy happens in the course of like a week. And there's no gap in time. There's no implication of like the other time that has happened where these characters have been able to grow in different ways and suggest much bigger character arcs that like you can't just do in one film. And if you have that suggestion of time and are able to signal that, you can get the audience to accept things that are much more dramatic than you otherwise would be able to do if it's with that very compressed time scale.
Yeah, it's why Episode 9 desperately needs to do like 5 years in the future.
Yes.
It's why I even think Episode 9 just shouldn't come out for a couple of years. Like, just let it kind of simmer. And it's also why I think Episode 9 shouldn't be the end of that story. Like, it feels like you need at least two more to do this.
Yeah.
Because Force Awakens and Last Jedi are almost like a two-parter in the way they're set up. Or, like, frankly, now it kind of feels like Force Awakens is a long prologue to The Last Jedi, where most of the action takes place. But it's just, it's inherently structured very differently. The Han Solo thing is fascinating to me because the Han Solo we get in this movie is, I think, what most people think of Han Solo being.
Yeah.
But it would have been very easy, and most sequels would do this, for Han makes this big choice at the end of A New Hope where he's like, I could have run, but I'm going to come back and help my buddy Luke, right? But I think most sequels would have reset him at the beginning of movie 2 to be jerk, scoundrel, runaway, like, yeah, I came back and helped, but I haven't really learned anything. And then they would have him do his arc all over again and get to the same place at the end.
That's basically like what the Pirates of the Caribbean movies would do with Captain Jack Sparrow.
Every single time, yeah, yes.
It's like, oh, I learned a lot, but people like me when I'm an asshole, so I have to be an asshole at the beginning of the next movie.
Right. So Han Solo, in this movie, it's not just that he grows over the course of Empire Strikes Back, which he does. It's that the growth he showed in A New Hope is not only respected, but expanded upon by the time you get to this scene, the beginning of this film. And that's part of why I think Han Solo registers so powerfully in this movie. And, he is probably the character, if you ask someone to talk about, like, what character you want to talk about from Empire, I think a lot would zero in on Han because he has such incredible scenes in this film. And part of that is allowing him to have that growth, having him be in a new place, and have him be on an active path of character growth that we kind of come back into in the middle of, right? And that's really interesting. And they also do it for Luke and Leia, who have, I think, less obvious growths. But, you can just see as much as, like, Carrie Fisher has so just settled into that part.
Yeah.
Leia feels like she has so settled into her role as, you know, leader of this rebellion. And her scenes with all types of characters are so interesting in this. But, of course, with Han, those two characters are on fire, obviously. And then Mark Hamill, you know, he is still not gruff, awesome, bearded Mark Hamill of The Last Jedi. But he is several magnitudes more confident an actor than he was in A New Hope.
Yeah, yeah. And the character is a lot more confident. Like, he's much more of, like, a warrior than a farmer boy.
Well, he's proactive, you know, because he makes proactive choices in A New Hope, but for a while he's more carried on by, like, the flow of fate or something. It's like, you know, that early stages of the hero's journey kind of thing. But in this one, every choice he makes is super active. Up to that, like, being the thing his character arc turns on, is he too active? Is he too restless? Yeah. Yoda directly calls him on this. And that's just, I mean, we're going all over the place. There's so many things to talk about with Empire Strikes Back. But what I love also about how they do character arcs here is that you can come in at the beginning of this movie and see how your heroes have progressed and be like, these characters are so cool. I'm so happy to be back with them. And then what the movie starts doing after that initial act is interrogating those personas. And while Han and Leia have some of the most, like, interesting scenes on that level, you know, they are the marquee characters on the film poster, for instance. Luke is actually very small on the poster. I'm looking at it right now. The Tauntaun is bigger, but it's okay. But, like, what they do with Luke is they really do question whether all the things we see in him are heroic.
Yeah.
It's not like they ever say he's a bad guy, but they very clearly zero in on flaws he has and flaws that lead to the bad things that happen to him at the end of the movie. And that he has to learn by virtue of his own mistakes, not just because other people do bad things. And I think that's also, it feels less revolutionary now because a lot of sequels like to do that, and smartly so. You should challenge your characters. But I think specifically how it challenges a character like Luke, who is fairly simple on the surface in that first film, is really interesting.
Yeah. But there's also, like, with the Luke stuff in this movie, I love how earnest it is. It's something, it is one of the qualities that is absolutely not lost from the first movie, is that sense of earnestness of just him, like, they just straight up, it's like, how will I know the good side from the bad side? You know, like, that dialogue that's, like, hokey, but is, like, feels truthful in many ways of, like, that is who he is, that is the world he lives in, is in this, like, very epic sense of, like, good and evil is something that he has to actually contend with and consider. And it makes Luke feel like this very thoughtful character. Even if he is being criticized for being too rash, he is thoughtful in his rashness. And I think there's an argument to have about whether or not Luke going is the right choice for him to make. But that's one of the most interesting things about this movie to me, is that whole Luke side of it. And the way that it is framed in such a way that I think you could very easily look at this movie and say, no, like what this movie is telling you is that Luke was making an error. He should have stayed with Yoda. He should have completed his training, and that is the path he should have been on. And how I feel about the movie is like, no, like, Luke made the right choice. And part of what this movie is doing is showing that, like, Luke needs to outgrow these mentor figures he has for himself. And it's in that last moment that he's finally able to do that, because they have been controlling him and manipulating him and, like, kind of putting him in this box, and him, like, encountering Darth Vader is what opens that up.
I'm really interested to talk about this, and we're going to get into that. Let's dive right into that in a minute here, because it's an interesting debate to have and a discussion to have, because I do think the movie wants you to, and I guess that's what I'm trying to get at, is it wants you to interrogate your hero's actions in a critical way, in a way you probably don't with most, particularly up to the year 1980, movie heroes.
Yeah.
They're either doing heroic things or not. You're not really thinking about the mistakes they might or might not be making. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I also do just want to shout out, like, Mark Hamill is not the actor who gets, I think, singled out the most in these first two Star Wars movies. I think he does more so in Return of the Jedi, because he's so amazing there.
And he gets a lot more meaty stuff in that movie to play.
But he's so good in both of these, and particularly in Empire Strikes Back. You just have to, it's easy to forget because he is so good, but think about the acting challenge he has in the middle act of this movie.
Yeah.
He is the only human on set for the vast majority of that second act, The only other person is Yoda, who is a puppet. The way all the Dagobah scenes were shot is that was a elevated set built in Elstree Studios in England, and Mark Hamill was on the set itself. Frank Oz and his team of puppeteers were beneath, and then Mark Hamill had an earpiece where he could hear what Frank Oz was saying so he could emote and react, but the earpiece didn't work very well. And in the behind the scenes, he talks about this, he would constantly get radio interference and hear like a baseball game or something. And I mean, it was England, so not baseball, football or something.
Cricket.
Yeah, cricket. But he would get that, and then he'd have to like act through it or just stop, and they would have to call cut. But it's seamless. Yeah. Like, we will praise Frank Oz and Yoda very profusely very soon, because it is one of the most impressive character creations of all time.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work without Mark Hamill, because Mark Hamill sells every inch of that as real. Like, if you look past Mark Hamill, Dagobah's a pretty cheap set. It doesn't look that great.
Yeah.
You know, like, Yoda is not a seamless puppet, although he's performed pretty seamlessly. But Mark Hamill is the guy who gets to ground all of that. And that's a very, I think, still rare quality in an actor.
Yeah. And again, he has to play the, like, naive, earnest, like, do-gooder, you know, which is not... That's not the sexy role to play. It's not Han Solo. He doesn't get to swagger around like Harrison Ford. He has to play this character that really does want to like tackle something larger than life and like do good in the world in a way that like Han Solo wants to be a good guy and help people out, but he's not looking to like defeat evil. You know, that's not the mission he set out for himself. Whereas like that's the path that Luke has to be on, and that's so much harder to play. That's so much harder to write, and it's the kind of thing that people. You know, I think people, as they age, go through phases with how they respond to a character like that. Obviously, when you're young, you respond usually very well. And then adolescents are like, ah, fuck it,
That's when you get into Batman.
Yes.
And for some people, never stop being in that phase.
Yes. But then you come back to Superman, hopefully as you mature, and be like, oh no, there's actually a lot of value in this, in seeing this, and approaching it with like an adult's perspective, and being able to interrogate it, and take some of that into your... And, like, some again, that earnestness is the word I keep coming back to, into your life, because it is really important. And it is something that is not thanked enough in writing and in performance and film and in literature and everything of that kind of character. But it is that sort of the character with the strong moral fiber and strong moral spine that does not really waver in their, like strong morality is something you so often don't get. And we so often praise the anti-hero so much. That I really love the earnest hero. I really like the hero that has that moral center to them, and think it tends to allow for much more interesting, varied stories than the anti-hero typically has, like the one anti-hero story that you always tell.
Well, we've talked about this a lot with, you know, Captain America and Black Panther in recent years, like getting back to this archetype that in its sort of moral straightforwardness is actually a lot more complex than the anti-hero stuff. I also think there's something structural about how Star Wars builds its main cast that makes that stand out so well, because they give you the, you know, the other side of it right there with Han Solo and with Leia, who are two much more, at least in these films, you know, human scale figures. And in Empire, it's a very clear juxtaposition, because you're cutting back and forth between, you know, Luke on a weird swamp planet, you know,
philosophizing with a wrinkly green man.
Exactly. With Han Solo and Leia dealing with like very immediate, like, concerns right this second.
Yeah.
And so you have that kind of the elevated and the grounded. And that is, I think Empire uses it the best, but Star Wars has always kind of built itself on these juxtapositions, and it's a really good way to do it. It's why they kind of went back to that exact same kind of setup with like the sequel trilogy, because that's a really durable character set. Harry Potter does that with Harry versus Ron and Hermione, or Naruto, fuck it, with, you know, his three people. Or
sure,
something.
Naruto,
I don't know,
Sasuke,
harder,
Sakura, not really,
not really,
no,
but like,
not,
yeah,
that's not at all. That's
not at all. That's a
I mean,
one.
Naruto has the earnestness, but it's a different thing.
Yes, very different thing. But anyway, yeah. So let's talk about, let's just get into it, because it feels like this is a meaty discussion to have.
Yeah.
Luke on Dagobah. We'll circle back around to Yoda in a second.
Okay.
But let's talk about, so he leaves at the end. Big decision, obviously. That's how the second act gets moved into the third, is that he has this premonition through the Force that something bad is going to happen to his friends. And Yoda urges him not to go. Obi-Wan urges him not to go because he needs to complete his training. If you value what they stand for, yes, as Yoda says to, should I let them die?
Yeah.
And Luke goes anyway. And I was watching closely this time to try to see, like, would Luke not going change things? Because it's an interesting thing to think about. And I actually don't think it would, because Leia And Lando and everyone, they get out of Cloud City completely on their own. Luke is not a part of that. Yeah. They very briefly cross paths. They do nothing to help Han. Like, I mean, he doesn't. He tries to help Han, but he's not able to. Like, Luke's presence there does not massively change the outcome for the other characters. It massively changes the outcome for Luke. And I think that's the interesting thing there. So, but you give your spiel now on why Luke maybe gives the right decision.
Well, I mean, it's... because Darth Vader's his dad, right? Like, and that's like such a huge, like, and it's something that it's very easy when you watch this movie to kind of forget how massive a revelation that is. But it is like, and it's something that if you want to talk about how good Mark Hamill is in this movie, like, he sells that scene so well of when he finds out and his world just falls apart. But the, and his world falls apart, and then he falls off the thing and is hanging, and like, all of that, from him getting his hand cut off and learning that Darth Vader is his father to the end of the movie, he plays so well of his sort of stages of kind of trying to understand what that means. And it's particularly what always sticks with me is when he's back on the Millennium Falcon and his hand is cut up and they're, like, trying to get away and he's sort of, like, on the medical bed before they're, like, repairing his hand and stuff. He's just like, why didn't you tell me, Ben?
Yes.
Why didn't you tell me? And that's something of it so recasts for me the role that Obi-Wan plays, the role that Yoda plays, and that they, and then it, when you're doing what we've been doing and watching it since the prequels, that is the thing that like hooks up so well to me with what the prequels are doing. Of it jacks in directly to what are many of the criticisms that the prequels levy upon the Jedi Order and the way that the Jedi operate, is that like that incredible detachedness, that impossible detachedness from material things, from your feelings, from the world around you, and this like call to you being so elevated above it that all of a sudden that stuff seems to have no meaning, and the way that that is so manipulative of the people that enter the Jedi Order, and it's what happens to Anakin, is that he can't live that life, and he feels so trapped by the very strict order he exists in that he feels like he can't reach out to anybody about like the incredible traumas that he has to live with about having grown up a slave, having witnessed his mother's death, and he can't open up about that with anybody because of the fear that that order instills upon him and that you know, the dogma of the Jedi Order instills upon him. And that echoes again, or like, you know, however you want to phrase it in terms of the chronology we're talking about, because it's very confusing. But Luke's choice feels like Luke is on a similar path to Anakin, but he doesn't go that way. It's when Darth Vader reaches out to him and says, I'm your father, you know, like, join me and together we shall rule the galaxy as father and son. That's a situation where Anakin maybe would have taken that hand, because Anakin also, like, is lonely, like, also, like, feels like he is destined for something greater. Also is, like, I mean, more so than Luke, but even Luke obviously grew up, had a very Peter Parker situation, aunt and uncle, father and mother missing, you know. But like, still there's a certain familial connection that is missing in Luke's life that he has now found in Darth Vader. And I think Anakin is a character that would like take that hand and say like, fuck it. Like, we've gone this far. What else am I going to do? And Luke says, no, fuck it. Like, I'm not going to change my path. And in fact, like, he, instead of, and this is something you then see in Return of the Jedi more, obviously, because this, we can only sort of gesture at it, but instead of going back to and being like, oh, Ben and Yoda were right, it's like, no, Ben and Yoda were fucking wrong. They should have told Luke. They should have been honest with Luke. They shouldn't have tried to manipulate Luke. And they should have taken that stuff and, like, the truth into it instead of trying to conceal it. Because what's interesting to me is thinking about the alternate scenario of Luke does complete his training, doesn't know, they don't tell him. Why would they tell him that Darth Vader is his dad? They're too, like, Ben and Yoda are too afraid to tell Luke that because, you know, who knows what he might do. And then encounters Darth Vader in that situation, and then he finds out, and he has, and now Luke has the power. Now Luke has trained in the Force. He's even more susceptible to the dark side at that point. As we see in Return of the Jedi, that once you are that much closer to having that incredible power, the more seductive it becomes. So I think it's, Luke needs to go through this trial. He needs to find this out. He needs to, like you said earlier, he needs to make these mistakes for himself, and he needs to grow past the restrictions and the dogma that his mentors live under that he doesn't have to live under.
I agree 100% with all of that. And I'm also thinking about how this is also the step that makes him the Luke of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Because the whole thematic thrust of Return of the Jedi to me, the, like the parts that work best of that film, which we'll get to in a couple weeks, I'm sure, is Luke very clearly becoming his own man, planting his own flag for what he's going to be as a Jedi and what the Jedi might be beyond him. Like, it is very much him graduating to being the hero of his own story without the shackles of other mentors, right?
Yeah.
And this is the step that has to happen for that to take place. Like, Empire pivots to Jedi so gracefully, and Jedi, I think, picks up that ball so gracefully, even if the second or third acts of that movie have issues, the first act does not. And so that is totally what this is. Like, you can debate whether or not it's the right choice for Luke in the moment and all these things, but what really reveals it as a great piece of storytelling is it is utterly 100% crucial for the story of the Star Wars trilogy, the Star Wars saga, to happen the way it needs to happen, right? And it doesn't feel convoluted. It feels alive in the moment. There's nothing predetermined about what Luke does there, I feel like. It feels very much like sort of messy and human, but as a lot of things happen in the world, it leads to where he kind of needs to go, ultimately.
Yeah, and that, it feels like, again, if you look at it in the bigger picture of incorporating the other movies that we've watched, it feels like Luke is, it is messy and human, and Luke is embracing the messy and human. That he's saying, like, no, like, because it's, because even, because if you think about the thing of, like, oh, does he actually make a difference in the fates of Han and Leia by going to Cloud City? No. But do you, like, really think that the guy who's so fucking callous that when he has this premonition and he knows that the, like, two most important people in his life are in danger, that he just sits by? Like even if... Yeah, because I feel like even if you tell Luke, like, oh, if you go, nothing will change, he would still fucking go. Because he has to. Because they're his friends. And he wants to be a good person. He's not necessarily, like, tied up in the philosophical bullshit of it all. And that's something I really, really like about his character, the way that this story treats it. It's like, it's not even necessarily important whether or not he actually is able to help Han and Leia. What is important is that he tries, and Yoda and Ben are at a point where they would not have tried. They would have given up. This is a, like... It's pointless. There's no reason to go. We need to do the strategic thing and train up and take out Darth Vader and the Emperor in one fell swoop. And it's like, no, that's not... You have lost sight of what you're actually trying to achieve, because that's how you set Luke on the path to being a Sith, because that's how you set Anakin on the path and everyone else on the path to joining the dark side.
My brother and I were talking about this a lot last night, that... We were just noticing all these places where it was really interesting to compare this to The Last Jedi.
Yeah.
Because this is the first time I've seen this since The Last Jedi came out.
Me too.
And The Last Jedi is in such deep, interesting conversation with The Empire Strikes Back. It borrows certain structural things from it, but I think in a very interesting, like, critical way. And it is also, like, very much, like, building its themes off the foundation of what The Empire Strikes Back is about. Like, it takes a lot of the subtext of this film and makes it text in, like, who Luke is when we see him there, the scene with Yoda, the ideas of, like, making mistakes and failure and getting back up, and, you know, takes them in different directions. But it is something that just, you know, people have such weird fucking bugs up their ass about The Last Jedi. But to me, it's like, it is one of the smartest Star Wars movies because it is in deep critical conversation with the other smartest Star Wars movie.
Yeah. Although there is something about it that, like, watching this has, like, made with, like, The Last Jedi, that there's something that, like, that's totally true what you're saying, and it's really well done in The Last Jedi, but there's something that is lost about, like, having it just so, allowing something to be its own thing, and there's something about, there's a missed storytelling opportunity, and I really love how they handle Luke in The Last Jedi, but there is something really frustrating about not having that character arc following all the way through of that he creates a Jedi Order that is different than the Jedi Order that came before him, because that's the path that he's set on. And there is something about, like, this sense, it's a much larger discussion to have about, like, narratives and storytelling in the 20, like, where we are in the 21st century and the way that, like, we're caught in cycles of meta-narrative and everything has to be a commentary on everything else in, like, franchise. Like, there's a lot of stuff wrapped up in that. But there's something very refreshing about watching Empire Strikes Back that is able to be removed from all of that, and it feels like there is no commentary on something else. Like, it is feels like it's very much its own story, forging its own path. And there's something about that, like... And this is not, like, a specific criticism of The Last Jedi. I think this is true of most movies that come out today. The media landscape we exist in makes it very hard for that to happen. But, like, things exist within, like, the abstract discourse or something.
Again, this is why there would be no Stanley Kubrick in the year 2018.
Exactly, yeah.
But it is, like, I mean, we're getting off topic, but, like, yeah. The Last Jedi, I think, is the Star Wars movie that needed to be made in 2017. And yeah. I think that's the Luke story that needed to be told in 2017. But it is all contextual. If you were making in the complete abstract, like, timelessness, is that the exact story I would tell with Luke? Probably not.
Yeah.
If you had made the sequel trilogy in the 90s or something... That's probably not where they would have gone with it. If you made it 10 years from now, I don't know. We might not be watching movies anymore. We might all be in camps because we don't... I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, but like, there's like the specific framework of like the relationship that the audience and the director and the people making the movie have with the franchise that this movie is a part of. There's like this complicated meta web that exists with so much media that we have to consume.
Yeah.
It's nice to watch something that's like, you can forget about all that shit
because
it was made fucking 40 years ago.
Empire Strikes Back is pretty well timeless. Yeah. Like, it could be made just about any time other than the effects being pretty specific to its period.
But
also transcendent of that period.
Let's use that to segue into, there's something about the effects that feels fucking timeless to me, and that's Yoda.
Yoda is one of the best effects in film history.
Yeah, he just fucking works. He works so perfectly.
It's eerie. It is literally like... I can't believe a puppet moves that way.
There's the shot where Yoda, you first meet him, and then he starts, it like cuts away to Luke or someone, then it cuts back to him, and he is rummaging through the refrigerator, and you see the back of him and his feet, and there's something so simple about, and I feel like they maybe did this on purpose, of that the first time you see him, he's very much framed, so you cannot see his lower half. In a way that you see most puppets framed, because most puppets don't have a lower half, right? So it's like, and you see that quite a lot, and then you get this one fucking money shot with the back of his feet, like right in the center of the frame, and there's just something about, like, that's not a puppet. That's like, there's something about that shot that communicates to me that is just a thing, that is a person, that is something on there.
That's no coincidence. The Muppet movie is, like, what, 5 years before this? And that's one of the first things they do with Kermit, is you go into the swamp where Kermit is singing Rainbow Connection, and he's a full-body Kermit, and then the next scene he's riding a bike. Like, and that's also Frank Oz, Jim Henson, all these guys. They were very much like, once you go to cinema, it's like, no, we're going to make sure you know these puppets are living, breathing things. And, yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing, is that Yoda is a Muppet. He's not as simple a Muppet as Kermit the Frog, but it's Frank Oz. It's a, like, I think the ILM built this puppet, but it is still built on, like, the basic principles of what Frank Oz had. Like, there's a reason they went and called Frank Oz.
Yeah.
And didn't just have random ILM guys take over this, because they looked at the Muppet movie and stuff, and clearly these guys knew what they were doing in making puppets come to life. And yeah, I think Yoda is just one of the best performances in any Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
And he is a puppet and a voice, and you never question it. It is so human. It is so real. There is so much nuance in his emotions. Frank Oz gives so much range in his vocal performance. It starts out as like 5 degrees left of Fozzie Bear.
Uh-huh.
And by the end, it is Yoda. It's just, there's no other way to say it. That's Yoda. And I think the best written dialogue in the entire franchise, the best written scene in the entire franchise, comes out of Yoda's mouth when he gives the explanation about the Force. And Irvin Kershner just shoots him like he would any other character. He is framed in that scene like a character. He comes across like a character. You don't think of it as an effect. You don't think of it as a puppet. You know, even when I see Yoda in, like, the prequels, the CGI Yoda is well done, but I never stop thinking that it's CGI and that it is a artificial creation. You can put that away really easily with Yoda in Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, for me, the most impressive bit of, like, Yoda acting where it really sells it is after you go back to his hovel and it's, like, that turn that happens of, oh, weird, funny hermit. Wait, you're Yoda? And he does that turn, like, it's a very sort of, like, Shakespearean thing of, like, he's sort of basically turned almost to the camera and just, like, is kind of talking off as, like, I cannot train the boy or whatever. And it's, like, his face just sort of sags. He loses the smile. Like, his whole, like, body language changes, which is something that is weird to say about a puppet, but it's 100% true that they went through and the different sort of points of articulation in the face and the rest of the body communicate so much about in that moment of, I was playing up this weird old swamp hermit, but I am actually Yoda, like the Grandmaster of the Jedi.
It's incredible. Like, because if Yoda didn't work, this movie falls the fuck apart.
Yep, that second act would be pretty fucking gruesome if you couldn't, like, be convinced by the Yoda stuff.
It really is the same as Gollum in The Two Towers. Yeah. Like, if they had not gotten Gollum just right in The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers would be pretty excruciating to watch.
Yep.
But they got Gollum perfect, and so it's a great movie. And the same for Empire Strikes Back. Like, it hinged on this thing. It was apparently a nightmare to figure out how to shoot and put together.
Sure.
But they did it, and you don't see any of that on screen. You just see the brilliance, the genius of how they put this together. And, you know, if you look closely and you're interested at all in, like, puppeteering and how they do Muppets and stuff, you can see where they have the different points of inflection on him. Like, one of my favorite things is that they are able to puppeteer the ears.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of emotion they do. Like, the way they do body language shifts is often through, like, the brow, mouth, ears, and shoulders. And, you know, they don't have every point in between all of those. There are things on the Yoda puppet that are static, but they're able to move those specific points, and the illusion is so complete. I actually think more complete than you can with some CGI characters where you have total control over all those different points, and then it's like there's too much maybe sometimes.
Yeah, that, like, there's something about, and it's true of, like, you know, like traditional 2D animation as well, that when you go simpler with the style, you are able to communicate big ideas easier and faster.
Yes.
That it's like you can, you know, it could take you 15 hours to draw this very, like, elaborate, like, Baroque style portrait of someone's face and very easily make it look like nothing is happening on them, whereas any child can draw a stick figure and make them look like they're happy, right?
Yes.
You know, like, there, that principle holds true. And so when you go for those simpler things, it can communicate stuff in a very direct way, and I think they do that with Yoda. And then the trick is with Yoda is to be able to do that and have it exist next to a real human person at the same time. When, like, finding that balance, it must have been fucking almost impossible.
Yeah.
Because I've never seen another puppet character and I've watched lots of movies that have lots of puppets, like, I love, like Labyrinth, but nothing has hit Yoda for me in that way. Like, the characterization is never quite as perfect as it is here.
Yeah. You know, Frank Oz is 74 years old. He's not going to be with us forever. I hope he has a long, long life.
Yeah.
But while Frank Oz is still alive, let's not eulogize him later. Frank Oz is a fucking genius.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Frank Oz is one of the greatest creative minds in cinema of the 20th century. Like, full stop, what he did on The Muppets alone is a filmography in and of itself. I mean, you go to his Wikipedia page and it starts with, you know, his career began as a puppeteer where he performed the Muppet characters of Miss Piggy, Fozzie Bear, Animal, and Sam Eagle in The Muppet Show, and Cookie Monster, Bert and Grover in Sesame Street. Ludicrous.
Yeah.
Think of how many pop culture titans did he create with felt and his voice, you know? And then he does Yoda in Star Wars. He eventually transitioned into being a movie director, and he's been up and down there, but he did make one of my favorite comedies of all time, which is What About Bob with Bill Murray.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yeah.
Fucking great. I love Frank Oz. There has never been anyone quite like him, I think, even in, like, the Muppets performing troupe, like, just his just range of everything he could do, and that's the guy you would go get to do Yoda, because he can make something like this come to life. And Yoda is truly an exemplary performance.
Yeah.
You know, like, there were a lot of discussions when Lord of the Rings came out about, should we try to get Andy Serkis an Oscar nomination? And they really tried, and the Academy didn't go for it. They still don't go for that. They wouldn't do it for the Planet of the Apes movies. But they should then. And frankly, they should have for Frank Oz as Yoda. That's a Best Supporting Actor nomination-worthy performance.
Yeah. No, I agree.
I think, look at the scene where he talks about the Force. I have seen Empire Strikes Back many times in my life. The scene, swamp, they're trying to get the ship out, and Yoda gives this speech about what the Force is to him and to the Jedi, and the words he says and the way he delivers it and the way it is shot, I feel like I'm a kid again. I am so immersed in that sequence, I forget I'm watching a movie. It is one of the most magical moments, I think, in film history.
Yeah, it's in particular in that sequence is when he says, it's my favorite line, and it's got the best little puppet action detail to sell the thing, is when he says, "Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter," and, like, pinches Luke on the cheek. Fucking perfect.
It's amazing.
Fucking perfect.
Well, and that they thought to, like, just have him poke him like that. Yeah. You know, it's so human in this weird way. I also love that scene as a character detail for Luke. I love that Luke is kind of petty at the end of it. Yeah. I love that he can absorb it, and it's something that I think later in his life is going to be, he's going to look back on as a major foundational moment, but he says, "You're asking the impossible," and walks off.
Yeah.
I like that they let Luke have that vulnerability there. Most scenes that would end with him being like, "You're right, Master Yoda, I'm going to redouble my training." But yeah. I like that it's not quite that.
Yeah, that like you can feel how much Luke is exasperated by this, what is a very understandably ridiculous fucking scenario all around, you know?
Yes.
It's he's on a swamp. Like, Dagobah looks like it would be fucking, it would suck to be on Dagobah. Like, he is sweaty, it looks so humid, he's having to run around and do cool flips with Yoda on his back while he's cackling in his ear. It's a lot to deal with.
While we're talking about Yoda, I also want to mention, in another comparison to The Last Jedi, there have been, you know, one of the complaints that sometimes annoys me about The Last Jedi is about the humor in that film. The Empire Strikes Back is a frequently silly movie. Like, it has a lot of jokes, and they are frequently very silly jokes. None more silly than Yoda trying to keep the light for himself, R2 stealing it back, and Yoda going, "Mine! Mine!" and just smacking him with a stick over and over again. I really just want to make a gif of that, and whenever people say Star Wars is, like, shouldn't be silly, I would just send that gif to them.
Well, and but the best part of that sequence is after that, and Luke's like, "Just give him the thing," and then Yoda's like, "Hur!" And then he takes his stick and closes the little panel on R2 with it. It's like, it's all those things that are the little the extra bits that were probably, like, really hard to get right in the film, but sell so much about Yoda being in that environment that he interacts so directly with R2-D2 that, like, it's that whole action, and then there's this little extra poke on top of it.
I love
sells
it. All right, we've talked about Yoda, we've talked about Luke. What else should we say about Han and Leia? We already got into it a little bit.
Harrison Ford's really fucking good in this movie.
He's
really I think this might be my favorite Harrison Ford performance, specifically this movie. Like,
it's
what he does, particularly at the beginning, because he has to carry so much about the first act of this film, because Luke is out of commission, being hung up, strung up by a fucking Wampa, and Han having to, like, run around the base and interact with all these people and trying to get to leave, and but then be like, "What do you mean that nobody's seen him?" And call, like, the deck captain. Like, all of that stuff is so perfect. It's really well written as a character introduction and, like, kind of hooking you into the movie. But Harrison Ford does so much to carry that and show the nuances of Han. Of you still see the little bits of, like, pettiness and, like, you know, scoundrelness in there. But it is his, like, gung-ho attitude and his, like, real care he has about Leia and Luke is so touching to me at the beginning of this movie, and so much of that is layered in the performance.
He's, yes, incredible. I'm don't make me pick my favorite Harrison Ford performance. Yeah. They're all good. But, well, not maybe later, but it depends. He goes up and down later in his career.
Yeah.
You know, he's been on an upswing lately, definitely.
It's like you can, I feel like you can dismiss the ones of where Harrison Ford obviously didn't give a shit that he was in the movie. Like,
that's the 90s and the 2000s.
Yeah, there's like the Harrison Ford performances when he liked being in the movie and the ones that he didn't care.
Yes.
And those are different Harrison Fords to me.
Very much so.
They're different Harrisons Ford.
Yes, different Harrisons Ford. But, you know, he's a movie star in this one.
Yeah.
And he was already the closest of the main group to being a movie star in that first movie, but he comes out on screen in this movie, and he's the guy who the following year, this is 1981, would become Indiana Jones and just tear up cinemas with one of the most, you know, one of the biggest blockbusters of all time. Like, he would, this is when he becomes the Harrison Ford who's going to just tear up the 1980s, you know?
They also give him the best costume in the movie. There's something about Harrison, like everything, it's just all perfect. It's so good. His hair is great. The costume is great. It's just something of, like, he's just fucking carries, like, those sections of this movie for me. Not to say that, like, the other stuff is bad, but, like, they put a lot on his shoulders to sort of, you know, because he's a that kind of larger-than-life character, and he pulls it off so fucking perfectly.
Yeah, I he has such a range of emotions in this one. I love the frustration he gets with Chewie in certain, where they're trying to fix the hyperdrive. But I also love, like, there's the ongoing arc of the hyperdrive not working, which carries from the very beginning to the very end of the film.
Yeah.
And which is great because it just delays the tension over and over again. It's like tension building 101 just done perfectly. But I love I think it's the second time the hyperdrive doesn't work. And he turns to Leia and he's like, "It's not my fault! It's not my fault!" And it's like, he has nothing else to say because he's like sad and embarrassed and just feels bad. Like, why? I worked so hard.
And then it's the similar sequence where they're trying to get away from Hoth and the TIE fighters are after them and they try to use the hyperdrive and it doesn't work. And he just gets up and runs. Like, it's just, you know, it's like someone fucking just like standing out, like jumping out of the car, like mid gun. Like, Leia's just saying this, like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, someone needs to pilot the ship. And he just is like, Chewie, we need to fix this. Just run into the back of the Falcon. It's really good.
He's fantastic. Carrie Fisher is also really good in this one. This is not her, like, biggest role in a Star Wars movie, but she kills every scene she's in.
Yeah.
And if you look up the word chemistry in the dictionary, it's Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher in Empire Strikes Back. Because if you, like, just look on the page, I don't know if they do much to sell the romance in this movie. It's a couple of scenes. Harrison, or Han Solo is kind of rapey, kind of like forcing himself on her, and that dynamic wasn't so much there in the last movie. And yet, you put it on screen with these actors and that direction, and the specific tone and atmosphere the movie conjures, and you don't question it. It's just, it's there, it's real, it's the emotional kind of spine of the movie, and every time I watch this film, I start to think in the middle act of all the stuff where they're on the asteroid, I maybe get a little bored with it, or I start to think, like, was this the best use of time? Like, it's kind of, they're just stuck on an asteroid for a while. But these scenes are really good. And that scene they have in the hallway, that's beautiful. And the way it, like, culminates in the kiss, and then C-3PO comes in is very funny. And I love all that. And then any doubts go away when you get to the end, and he's frozen in carbonite, and you have the, I love you, I know.
Yeah.
And the culmination of that arc, and you're like, yes, every second we spent on this was worthwhile, and they did it all perfectly, because that moment fucking landed, and it would not land if you didn't have everything else perfectly in place.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, that's the way that character arc resolves. Because I always kind of forget also that Harrison Ford is not in, like, the last half hour of this movie.
Yeah, right.
I forget kind of how early it is that he gets frozen, but man, is that to take, like, one of your main three characters and just put him out of commission for most of the last act of your film is a really fascinating move. And just the music and the production design and the direction and the acting and the editing of that sequence is such a perfect convergence of creating a giant emotional wallop to send us into those, you know, that last half hour of the film.
Yeah.
Really incredible stuff.
Yeah. It's just like the whole pacing of this movie is pitch fucking perfect.
Pitch perfect. All right. You want to talk about Mr. Darth Vader?
Oh, man. Dude, Darth Vader in this movie. Because in the first movie, he's good, but it's the suit and the voice.
We even talked about this, that I think you could very easily make the argument that Grand Moff Tarkin is the more interesting villain in the first Star Wars. If you could, and it's hard now to, like, put your other, like, preconceived notions of who Darth Vader is off the table. But imagine you're seeing it for the first time. I can imagine you being more taken with the Tarkin performance than the Vader one.
Yeah, but in this movie, especially because, like, he's given basically as much time as any of the other threads. As, like, the movie typically goes Han, Leia, Luke, Vader, and cuts that way, and just, like, keeps on cutting along those lines, and you just keep on reentering those threads as Vader is just, like, very thoroughly, very persistently trying to get Luke. And it's like, that's what you find out in the opening crawl, is he's searching for Luke Skywalker, and that's what you get for, like, the whole movie. He's trying to find Hoth, because he knows that Luke is on Hoth, or, like, not Hoth specifically, but the Rebel base, because he knows Luke is somewhere around here. So he gets that, it's like he needs to find, like, either get Luke or get Han and Leia, and then, like, hatch this whole scheme. And it's that stuff of him just pushing things in the background and manipulating things, and the way he just takes complete charge and every single scene he's in, you know, he's constantly fucking just killing people. He kills, like, three Imperial officers, I think, in this movie, just force-choking them and then doing the, like, super badass thing of just choking one dude and saying, "Now you make sure you capture them, Admiral." And it's like, that's something that, like, you know, I don't really give a shit about, like, climbing the corporate ladder and all that kind of stuff. Like, there's a reason why I'm becoming a teacher and not, like, an office worker. But the one thing I would love to be able to do if you were in the military or that, like, you know, working in a company really high up, is that of being able to just, not murder people, but just, like, say to somebody, like, "Get it done, Sergeant," you know, and just like promote somebody on the fly. It's such a fucking cool ass move. And he does, and it's sort of undermined a little bit by him immediately, it being immediately preceded by him having murdered somebody. And I'd like to imagine that the Emperor has to, you know, hollow vid Darth Vader every once in a while and be like, I get it, you know, they failed this thing. But there are only so many people qualified to be commander of a Star Destroyer. Like, it seems like that's a really hard, very technical position that requires years of experience to be able to get to that point. And you can't just kill all of them. And there's not always going to be very conveniently another dude standing right there that you can just be that can just be admiral. Like, one time you accidentally made the janitor admiral of the Super Star Destroyer, and it's like, that didn't work out. It's just, they can't just be standing there, Vader.
It's so great, because it is both this crazy badass thing that like it really enmeshes Darth Vader's character. It's also a phenomenal running joke.
Yeah.
That he just keeps killing people and promoting the person standing next to them, and that like near the end the guy who was promoted to admiral earlier is like, I'll take full responsibility for this, and he like straightens up and he goes off to die because he just knows. And then when we cut, it's to his body like crumpling. We don't even show the full scene.
Yeah, that's probably the best one is when Han and Leia in the Millennium Falcon get away, and the guy who's like the captain of that Star Destroyer in that scene saying like, I'll go to the Super Star Destroyer and apologize to Lord Vader personally. And then it cuts to Luke. And then when it cuts to the Vader storyline, it's just that dude crumpling to the ground and Vader saying, apology accepted, Captain, and walking away. It's so good.
It's so great. Because I love, you have to assume Vader does not do this all the time, or else, as you say, they would run out of people.
Yeah.
But I like that he's just having a particularly bad week, and it's like, fuck it, you're not fired, you're dead.
Yeah.
He's great. No, Vader is amazing. And then, I think you've mentioned this before. I think you mentioned this last time we talked. But like the moment Darth Vader becomes fully 100% Darth Vader is when you're on Cloud City and Lando is giving them the whole spiel about how, you know, he's made a deal that's going to keep the Empire out of here forever. And then they open the door and Vader is sitting at the end of the dinner table, patiently waiting. Han pulls out his blaster to shoot and Vader just catches the bullet.
Yeah, It's the best scene in Star Wars. It's so good. There's so much about, because it's just fucking perfect. The way it's edited and everything is put together, and that reveal of Darth Vader just sitting at the head of the table. Yeah, Han pulls the gun, fires a couple of blaster bolts. Darth Vader just blocks it with his hand, like uses the force to pull away the gun. And I forget what the exact line is, but it's like, you may be seated, Captain, or something like that.
He says, would you like to join us?
Would you like to join us?
Yes.
And it's just the fucking badass, super casual way he handles that. Again, everything he does in the movie, he's just effortless for him. He's toying with everybody. He has everything under control. The only reason anything goes wrong is because there are so many other people having to be involved in this process.
Yes.
That they're the ones that fuck up, not Darth Vader. That makes him such an intimidating villain.
And when we talk about characters being in different places in this film, Darth Vader is too, actually. Because it's easy to forget he is not the commander of things in Star Wars. Tarkin, and Tarkin even reins him in a couple of times. And then in this movie, it's like, Vader's unleashed. He's force choking everybody. He's going around. He's getting shit done.
He's having very fancy dinners on Cloud City.
I've always wished we got the scene right after that in Cloud City where, like, they sit down and I just imagine food is served and Darth Vader says, please, Boba Fett, take a seat. And just, like, makes everyone have a very awkward meal with, I assume he can't eat because he's Darth Vader, and he just watches them eat creepily.
Or no, I think he just, like, sort of, like, sticks a food tube under his mask or something and is standing there just like, so, Captain Solo, I see that you used to be a pilot in the Imperial Academy. Have you thought about this offer of coming back and joining us again? I promise I will make it worth your while.
I see, Han Solo, in your file, we gave you that name because you were alone as a child. I'm kidding. We did make that joke last night. The first time Han Solo's name is made is like, that's less cool now.
Yeah.
Because of the Solo movie. Anyway, Darth Vader's awesome. The last fight.
Uh-huh.
Should we talk about it?
Yes. Yeah. Because that's, again, that's where so much of the body language of Vader in that fight is so perfect in the way that he's just toying with Luke. That entire fight, Luke, like, it's only at the very end when things get a little bit frantic that Vader gets, like, a little, like, love tap on his arm, and that's what kind of pushes him over the edge a bit to be like, ah, fuck, I'm gonna cut his hand off, like, little brat. but up until that moment, he's just fucking with him entirely, you know? He's just trying to put, like, at first it's just trying to get him into the, like, cryogenic thing to freeze him, and I love that little bit of where he... you know, sort of like pushes Luke enough and kind of has manipulated the spacing of the fight enough to have Luke trip into that thing, and he just turns around and walks away. He's all too easy. And then Luke does the weird jump up into the thing. It's like, oh, impressive. And that, like, and that's where you get this sense of, okay, the fight is becoming something. Like, this is, it's more than just like, I can't just sort of like throw you in a hole and you're going to turn, like, you know, get carbonated. We have to have this whole fight. Just everything in that fight. All the dialogue, the riot, just everything. It's so fucking good.
I was talking to you about this before we went on the air, that I think once you get to Cloud City, but particularly once Luke gets there and they are in conflict, this movie is cooking with gasoline. It is impossible to look away from. It is so... I know every beat of what's going to happen, like shot for shot, and it is still so utterly riveting. I think part of it is just how well shot it is. My two favorite shots in this movie, and it's a shot-reverse shot, is... when Luke notices Vader is there, and it's a shot with Luke is like in the left-hand side of the frame, and it's just so perfectly framed with the blue on top, the red on bottom, kind of blackness in the middle, and he just has this look of like determination, like, I'm going to do this. And then you cut, and you see what he's seeing, which is Vader, like, long shot, he's way off, also that blue-red thing, Vader looking very much silhouette-esque, and ignites his lightsaber. It's a hell of a shot.
Yeah, well, because in the way that sequence works out, where, like, Luke goes up the stairs, and I love that Luke turns his lightsaber on first, and then they, like... I swear they make Darth Vader's lightsaber turn on slower to just make it that much more, like... it's nothing to him. That, like, Luke strikes this whole pose. Darth Vader's just standing there and just turns the lightsaber on. It's just like... and it just sort of, like, slowly goes out. It's like, I don't need to... this, like, fast draw to take you out, buddy. Like, okay, let's do this. And he's, like, doesn't even really strike much of a fighting stance at the beginning.
No, he's doing it, like, one-handed, right?
Yeah, he's just sort of, like, shoving him around. Yeah.
And it's still so well choreographed and so well directed. But then I love when it gets into the second phase where they go down, like, another level.
Yeah.
And Vader comes in. Kind of, now he's like, they're basically treating him like a slasher villain at this point.
Yeah, he's like the Predator or something.
Yep. And he starts force throwing all this shit at Luke. That is an incredible, like, the music there and just how much Luke is suffering and how Vader is just fucking with this kid.
Yeah, it's like he doesn't even need to sword fight him. He's just like, I can just throw rocks at you, buddy. Yeah. Like, this is how bad you are.
And then Luke gets tossed out the window, lands down on the bridge below, and maybe my favorite use of Vader other than the dinner scene, like, as a physical presence, is Luke going through this tunnel. He kind of comes out, and Vader just comes out of the blackness.
Yeah.
Very much like Jason or something, you know, just like coming out with the lightsaber and just attacking.
Yeah.
And the ferociousness of it. Like, you so feel Luke being out of his depth and trying to hold up. And he's doing a pretty good job for a rookie.
Yeah.
But it does end with him getting his hand chopped off because he's not going to last that long.
Yeah. Well, and then, like, Darth Vader's not trying to kill him. Vader's all that Darth Vader wants is, like, to have Luke. He doesn't want to destroy Luke. He's just like, I need you. You're my son. But it's like, even before that specific motivation is established, there is that, like, his whole mission is to get Luke, not to destroy him. And so that dynamic, it makes the fight so interesting to me, that it isn't this sort of, like, you know, it's not where we are in Return of the Jedi, where it is this, like, duel of equals, or what we usually get in the other lightsaber fights in this series, where it's kind of a duel of equals. It's, you know, what we got last time with Ben and Darth Vader's, like, kind of feels like they're kind of even keel, and Ben kind of just sort of like, eh, fuck it, you know, I've had a good run. There's the logic of what Obi-Wan does in that movie is a little weird, but you just kind of roll with it because it sells it pretty well. But yeah, but this is one where it's like Luke is 100% out of his depth the entirety of that fight. If Darth Vader wanted him dead, he would be dead fucking immediately.
Yes, and the staging, once he's got his hand cut off and, like, what he does next is so well done, where I love that they're on this big, weird, long bridge thing over the big depths of Cloud City, and Luke just keeps crawling away from Vader. Like, he will not give in, even though he's literally running out of space to move. He goes all the way out, onto this like hanger thing, and he's just on this like little tiny strip of metal or something standing there with his arm wrapped around it so he won't fall off, and he's gone to the absolute edge he can. And I love that that is where we're going with it while Vader delivers the revelation, "No, I am your father."
Yeah.
And I love that you're talking about how great Mark Hamill's performance is there, and it is, but I also love how much the fight has put him into this physical vulnerability, and like the makeup and the costuming there where he's got, you know, his bloody stump, and he is like covered in like, you know, just dirt, and he's and sweat,
and bruises, and bruises, and cuts, and because he's just been battered all over with all this shit.
Yeah, and so he is. It's a very expressionistic thing. Like he is literally on the edge. He is literally battered at this moment, and then he learns the worst thing he could learn. And no!
That's not true. That's impossible.
It's so good. Again, put those lines in someone else's mouth. That could be a very bad scene. It is so well done.
Yeah.
Vader's body language is so great there. It's something we haven't talked about yet, but if you look in the first Star Wars movie, the matching between James Earl Jones' voice and David Prowse's physical acting is not very well synced up.
Yeah, because they hadn't fully decided at that point how they were going to do it.
It's so well done here. Yeah. Like, all of it, like Vader, like David Prowse is giving a really specific physical performance, and James Earl Jones is layering on a very specific vocal performance, and it comes together so perfectly.
Yeah, the writing is also much sharper. Like, like Darth Vader's a character that shouldn't have the dopey lines, and he has a couple of dopey lines in the first movie. Here, all of his dialogue is very deliberate and sharp and well done.
And just, so Luke has his breakdown, and then I love how they play the moment where Luke just looks at Vader, looks down, looks up, and is like, "I'll take my chances," and just jumps, because it's all about the power dynamics of that scene. As you were saying, Vader wants to collect Luke, and Luke makes the decision, "No, the way I beat this guy is by not giving him what he wants," and he jumps. And I love Vader's just kind of, they don't do a vocal thing, they just let David Prowse do this kind of like dejected, like look like slump kind of down, and it's like, you can just hear in his mind, he's like, "Oh, fuck, that didn't go the way I thought that would go."
Yeah, like it went a lot better in my head, I'm going to be honest, you know. Like, I was sitting around at the head of that dinner table for a couple of hours waiting for Han Solo to show up, planning this out, and it didn't work. I was hoping he'd just fall into the freezy thing and be frozen, and it would all been good.
It is kind of interesting, because Vader has, you know, Vader in some ways very much wins this round, because he gets Han Solo, and he beats the shit out of Luke Skywalker, and a lot of things go right for him, but he also kind of loses in the end, which is why I love that "bring my shuttle" line that they fuck up in the special edition, because that's where you feel the weight of it on him, of like, he had this all so perfectly planned, he was so powerful, and yet the thing he wanted still ultimately got away from him, and James Earl Jones is able to just put that into three words. That is just great filmmaking.
Yeah. It's also something that, it's an element of that scene that I love that works with the prequels really well and kind of develops that idea of him, like, because it's not just like, "join me," it's "join me and we shall rule the galaxy together as father and son," that together they'd be enough to defeat the Emperor. And I love that, like, that's where Vader is, and then particularly when you link it up with the prequels, it makes so much sense of, like, I feel like I see Anakin in that moment, even though they haven't, obviously, in making the movie, had been at that point, and had all, like, that was, like, the whole concept, that it shines through really well of, this is a guy who has been so beaten and tortured in this role that, like, that he sees this one glimmer of hope, and it's like, oh, now I can do this. Like, now I can make things right in his mind by him ruling things, because he would do it the right way. Because of course Anakin would think that, because he's a fucking asshole.
Yes.
And an idiot. But like, there's something about that dynamic that works so well with me with the prequels.
Also, because the prequels, in his scene with Padme at the end of episode 3, do the echo of he offers to rule the galaxy with her. I do love the there is a consistent thing with Darth Vader. He just wants to rule the galaxy with his family.
Yeah.
And he never gets to, and he's very sad because none of his family wants to rule the galaxy with him.
Yeah.
He never got to do it to Leia. That's too bad. He didn't get to offer Leia,
"Join me and together we shall rule the galaxy as father and daughter." And then later there's like a distant cousin that's like, "Join me and together we shall rule the galaxy as cousins twice removed."
So they just keep saying no. He's like, "I thought I'd get it this time."
Like, next time I'll do a bit more setup. You know, I won't leave it until after I've cut your hand off. I'll tell you before I cut your hand off. That'll work better.
I have to sell you on me. That's what all the books say.
Yeah. But, yeah, but I also just, but going back to this, like, I love the idea that Anakin has spent, like, 20, 30 years, however long it's been, just trying to find a way to kill the Emperor. Like, that's, because, again, that's, I think that's what I mean when I say that, like, it, I see Anakin in that, is that you see, like, he's not really been doing this stuff that willingly. Like, he has not wanted to do any of this. There's, like, a bit of almost, like, a vaguely, like, Stockholm Syndrome-y thing to it of, like, there's nothing else he can do, so he's just been going along with it.
Which is, again, what episode 3 so nicely sets in stone, I think, with the last scene with Vader, where he comes onto the bridge of the Star Destroyer and looks out and crosses his arms, and it's just like, you get that sense of like, I'm here for now, I'm biding my time.
Yeah.
At some point I'll strike. And it takes a very, very long time, but he does eventually.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I just think that dynamic to this instance, and then also if you just ignore the rest of like the Star Wars stuff we know now with the prequels and everything else, in the moment, I think it is also an interesting choice of that, like, that is Darth Vader's motivation. It's one of the things that makes his character more interesting and stand out more. Uh-huh. Even if you don't know Anakin, is that, like, this is not, he's not a lackey. That's not what he's looking for. Like, he is doing the dark side ambitious thing of, like, I am always looking to find the way to be the one at the top, because that's what it means to be a part of the dark side, is like cutting away everything that is above me until there's nothing left because I'm the best around.
Exactly. Yeah. So Darth Vader is cool. All these characters are great. This is a great movie.
Yep.
Let's talk about some of the people who worked on it.
Okay. I thought you were going to say, let's talk about the best character in the movie, Boba Fett.
Boba Fett is fine in this movie.
He's fine. Favorite thing about Boba Fett in this movie, I don't know if this is in the other versions in the special editions, because they might have taken this out. But it's very noticeable in the scene where he is, like, walking Han Solo's carbonated whatever thing, like, slab around, is he has spur sound effects on his footsteps. Like, full on, he's a fucking cowboy, like, straight up. I haven't gone and watched the special editions to see if, like, that's still there and maybe different in the sound mix, or I just never noticed it. And that scene is like, those motherfuckers, like, it is accentuated more when you have the original vocal performance that is very much a cowboy voice.
Yes.
It's not the, like, Jango Fett voice.
I will say, I do like Boba Fett a lot more with the theatrical edition voice. I think the Jango Fett clone voice is pretty boring in the special edition. And I do like that he's just this Western hero.
Yeah, he's just got, like, a Southern twang to it, which doesn't really make sense, but it's fine.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I like Boba Fett pretty well in this movie.
Yeah.
I think he's a really good piece of window dressing on the film.
Yeah,
of, like,
there's that really good bit when the Millennium Falcon gets away in, like, all the trash, and then Boba Fett's Slave 2 ship turns on and follows them. That's a great little bit.
It's a great costume. He does a great pose at one point. By no means, on the virtue of this one film, would I ever expect Boba Fett to be what he has become, but that's fandom for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Boba Fett cartoon from the Christmas special, on the other hand.
That's where it's at, no. Actually, what it is at, where it is at, is Bosk. He is the best. Do you know who Bosk is?
Is he the bounty hunter who looks like he's out of a Star Trek reject pool?
The lizard man?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. He's that there is one of the other really great little bits in Empire Strikes Back is when all the bounty hunters are on the bridge of the Star Destroyer, and then I think it's Admiral Piet turns around and just sees big lizard feet right in his face on that ledge, and then, like, looks up and the camera pans up at Bosk. It's a great shot.
It's great.
It's dumb. But it's kind of like what you're saying of, like, people being like, oh, the Star Wars was always super serious. It's like, that's a shot from a fucking Marvel movie. That's 100%.
Well, that whole scene, I think, is pretty self-aware about. It has all these ridiculous bounty hunters in the room and Darth Vader.
No disintegrations.
That's a joke. The no disintegrations thing is a silly joke, and it's funny, and it works. Like, Star Wars never took itself too seriously.
Yeah.
It always had a certain lightness in its step, and this one does too. Even if this is probably the most serious of the original Star Wars movies,
it's like still got suddenly. Big lizard feet.
Big lizard feet, yes. So some of the people who worked on this,
First
off, the maestro John Williams.
Oh,
we've talked about it for each one. I don't know which Star Wars scores are the best at this point. They're all pretty great.
I feel like we've said for all of them, this is like one of the best Star Wars scores, which is true. They're all one of the best Star Wars scores.
They are. And the Empire Strikes Back score, Sean? It's one of the best Star Wars scores.
It's very true. It's really good.
I mean, obviously, this is when he's still introducing a bunch of new themes. Like, this is where we get the Imperial March. This is where we get Yoda's theme. We get a much bigger version of Leia's theme that sort of becomes also Han's theme in this movie, effectively, because they kind of share a lot of musical identity. But just, I was noticing watching it this time, moment to moment, the music in this is really good at, like, underlining action. Like, one of my favorite cues in any Star Wars movie is the asteroid field scene, which is a famous cue, but, like, watch the scene and listen to how the music underlines all of that. It's really fantastic, because that's a very good action sequence on its own. It's a really cool scene, but I think the music elevates it to a whole other level, and that is consistent here. John Williams just, he has a crazy, like, telepathic spiritual connection to the celluloid he is scoring, where it just feels like he emanates the perfect music out of those visuals at every point. And, just for good measure, gives us one of the single most iconic film themes in film history with the Imperial March.
Yeah. One of the pieces of music in this movie that has been utterly ruined for me by the video games, I think I might have mentioned this on a podcast at some point, is the one where it cuts, it's near the beginning, it's after Han and Luke have, like, sheltered away for the night, and Han has found Luke, and then the next morning the snow speeder's going over, and it's the
I love that one.
That fucking piece of music is used so much in every Star Wars video game ever, just constantly. But it's like, but the worst part is it's so often just put on a loop, and so you just hear it over and over again. It's a great piece of music. It's good, so well done with the edit in the movie. I can't hear it anymore. I can't hear it without thinking about, like every Star Wars video game I've ever played just flashes before my eyes as soon as that music cue comes up. It's like, Star Wars video games should do more original music. It worked well in KOTOR. You can do it. You can do some of it.
But this score is so good.
Yeah.
Like, the way this one cuts to credits at the end with the Imperial, not the Imperial, the Rebel fleet, and that beautiful, beautiful shot of Luke and Leia and 3PO and R2-D2 looking out the window together at the ships, and then all the ships, and it's playing a big version of Leia's theme, basically, into the credits.
Yeah.
Stunning. Maybe the best Star Wars ending.
I think it is.
It's so gosh darn good. Because this is a bleak movie with a bleak ending, and yet it manages to end on this sort of, like, hopeful, forward-looking note, without feeling like it's cheating us, without feeling like it's undercutting any of the darker emotions of these scenes. I think a lot of that is Williams. I think Williams knows exactly how to thread those needles, and he's doing it in a very big way. Star Wars scores are not subtle, but man, it works. And this is just another one where I can always imagine every part of a Star Wars movie is really hard to make and is probably hellish to go through. But then you get to put an edit on screen and listen to what John Williams sent you, and as George Lucas or Irvin Kershner, whoever, you just must lean back and be like,
Thank God.
Thank you. They're like, it works. It works. John Williams, I don't have to worry about it. He did it. It's perfect. Yeah. It's so good. It's better than I could ever hope. I'm so lucky. You know? And just now, and that is one thing I do think is cool about new people getting to direct Star Wars movies, is they get to have that emotion of, it works. You know, thank God. I got to work with John Williams. This is amazing. Ryan Johnson even was so into it. At my screening of The Last Jedi, the, like, Thursday night opening, I don't know if they did this at other screenings, they did a 5-minute featurette before the movie.
I did not see that.
Yeah, I think it was only for the Thursday night previews, of Ryan Johnson, like, just layering effusive praise on John Williams, and we saw, like, John Williams conducting a scene from the movie. It was really cool. And it was just like, if I were Ryan Johnson, and it was like, and I got the Star Wars gig, the first thing I would be thinking about is, I get to work with John Williams. I get to, oh my God. No one gets to do this.
And then it's like, and I get to direct Mark Hamill.
Yes.
Holy shit, I need to get a Joker printout for him to sign.
Yes, I'm sure that was a Joker printout for him to sign, and I don't know, like a Jaws CD for John Williams to sign. All right. Anyway, John Williams. But John Williams is, we know John Williams. We know, you know, George Lucas and a lot of the other people here. But Empire Strikes Back is the first movie where Lucas moved much more into a producer role, which has been kind of his main mode in film ever since. Now, he did come back and direct the prequels.
Yeah.
Although, even when they were starting out, he did not intend to direct the prequels. He was looking for a director to do it forever, and every director who he looked at said, you clearly want to direct this movie, you should direct it, and he finally did. But Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, he did not direct, with the asterisk that I think most people assume he directed at least half of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
But we'll get into that next month. This one, he did not. This is Irvin Kershner. Irvin Kershner is a really good director. He is not like an auteur in the sense of someone who like had a really clearly identifiable style and made, you know, an infinite number of classics or anything.
But he did make RoboCop 2.
He made RoboCop 2. And he made a lot of interesting films in his career. He was a very, very, you know, good, competent Hollywood studio guy. This was almost certainly his finest hour, but I do think he brought a level of like technical expertise and maturity and confidence to this that the original Star Wars, you know, did not have by virtue of it being a, you know, kind of a film brat era movie. Yeah. And there is something to this that, you know, you can look at the ups and downs of his career, and there are ups and there are downs, and he made some really interesting movies and some less interesting movies. But Empire Strikes Back is pretty well regarded as a masterpiece, and he did direct this thing, and I don't think you can ever look at him as like a minor filmmaker when yeah. this is on his filmography.
No, absolutely. This yeah. and RoboCop 2, which is legitimately actually very good.
Yes. Looking through here, if there's any others to mention. But yeah, he also did 3 years after this, his follow-up, like his commercial like pat on the back for doing Star Wars, was he did the James Bond knockoff movie, Never Say Never Again, which is the one where they brought Sean Connery back, but a different studio made it, and it's a remake of Thunderball, because the co-writer of Thunderball, Kevin McClory, has always had the rights to that one, and so he wanted to make a James Bond movie that would go head-to-head with that summer's other James Bond movie, Octopussy, and so...
You've never heard of this? I've never heard of this. Yeah, I have no idea.
I have not seen the whole thing. It's fucking bizarre. It's Irving Kirshner.
Is the character named James Bond?
Yes, because Kevin McClory... This would never happen today, but Kevin McClory had the rights to Thunderball, the film rights to it, and so he could use anything that was in that book.
Fuck.
And so he did it again, and it is Sean Connery, who was in the original Thunderball,
yeah.
and it's other different actors, but it's Irving Kirshner. They could not use the James Bond theme, or it's not an Eon movie. It's not an official James Bond movie. So it's like a knockoff, but he is still James Bond, and it was actually Sean Connery. And they got Irving Kirshner, who was pretty hot shit after Empire Strikes Back. And yeah, it is one of the weirdest chapters. And Kevin McClory, before he died, tried to do it again in the Daniel Craig era. We're going to go
with Thunderball again?
Yes, because that's the only one he owns. That's all he can do. He's dead now, so it doesn't really matter. But yes, kind of crazy, huh?
That would be like if, I forget the name of the director, but the guy who made Manhunter, the Hannibal Lecter movie, made that after Silence of the Lambs.
Yes.
Like, confusing.
Yes. Anyway, that is a little bit of Irving Kirshner trivia. I also always loved hearing him talk about this movie, because he would participate in the bonus features and stuff for the DVDs.
Yeah.
Really thoughtful guy, clearly poured his heart and soul into this film, and was so clearly a great choice. So, yeah. That's awesome. The screenplay for this one, George Lucas's name is not on it. He got a story by credit. Now, he did do extensive writing on the film, so it's him. But it was also two writers, Lawrence Kasdan, who we all know, because he also would co-write Return of the Jedi. I think he also co-wrote Attack of the Clones. He co-wrote Force Awakens, and he just wrote Solo, A Star Wars Story. But of course,
he got to put his passion project Darth Maul in there.
Yes.
I wanted more than anything.
I don't think Lawrence Kasdan wrote that scene. Anyway, probably Lawrence not. Kasdan, of course, wrote a bunch of other famous movies in this era. He wrote later Raiders of the Lost Ark, right. The Big Chill, got a movie, Wyatt Earp. I'm just looking at some of his, like, he kind of slowed down later on in life, but was definitely a major force in the 80s. And definitely
major force.
That's not what I meant. But definitely one of the main, I think, you know, authorial voices of Star Wars because yeah. of this foundational work. He was brought on to do rewrites after the original writer of the film died. And that writer was Lee Brackett. And she's a really interesting case because she was an early, like, Hollywood writer, like Golden Age Hollywood writer, who wrote some really famous films. She wrote The Big Sleep, Rio Bravo, and The Long Goodbye. Those are the first three on her Wikipedia article. I could go into more, but those are all, like, pillar yeah. movies. Like, she was a huge force, and she was actually nearing the end of her life when she was hired for Empire Strikes Back, and she died in 1978 after delivering the first draft of the film. There has always been debate over how much of her work is in the finished film and how much Lucas kept. But recent, like, scholarship on this and people, like, because the screenplays have been published or they've leaked or something, mm-hmm. people do agree, like, the shape of this movie is in there. All the big moments are there. There are things that are different, but you cannot, like, discount her contributions to the film because the basic shape of Empire Strikes Back is there in what she wrote. After she passed away, Lucas did the initial round of rewrites, and then it was actually after Lawrence Kasdan had delivered the script for Raiders of the Lost Ark, And they said, this guy's really good, and they hired him for Empire, and he did the final drafts of Empire. So it was those three people kind of put it together. But I would not be surprised if, I would have to, you know, look at the screenplay myself and figure this out, but I wouldn't be surprised if Lee Brackett, if her major contribution to this one might actually be in some of the dialogue and how, because there is so much more artistry to a lot of the dialogue in this one than there was in A New Hope. And like, if you look at like Yoda's speech or some of the stuff between Han and Leia, especially the Han and Leia stuff, really, like, yes, the writer of The Big Sleep probably had hand in that.
Yeah, there's a very, like, 40s golden age Hollywood romance quality to it, for sure.
Yeah, so I think she's the only woman who's ever been credited for writing a Star Wars movie. But Lee Brackett, really interesting person, huge, you know, force in early Hollywood, and an interesting connection here for The Empire Strikes Back. Yeah, so there's a little history lesson there. Those are the people who worked on this one. A lot of the same people would carry over to Return of the Jedi, although we would get the new director, Richard Marquand, who we don't really know how much of it he directed. But we'll talk about that next time.
Yeah.
Anyway, The Empire Strikes Back. Just wanted to highlight some of those people. What else should we say about this great, great film?
One thing I realized when we were going over the characters, we kind of skipped over, unfortunately, was Billy Dee Williams.
Oh, and God, yeah.
Lando Calrissian. And I want to talk both about that, and because I think it is was very much a part of my experience watching this movie. Was that and Solo, A Star Wars Story, and putting those things in juxtaposition. Because it was kind of weird.
It is kind of weird. Yeah.
Billy Dee Williams is fucking awesome as Lando. So good in this movie.
He's so good. It made me appreciate Donald Glover even more. Yes. Because Donald Glover fucking nailed it.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, he's great. I forgot that, I mean, I knew he was in the third act, so like it's later in the movie, but I always forget you don't see him until relatively late in the film.
Yeah.
And he just makes such an immediate impression. He has to play a pretty complicated arc in a pretty short amount of time in that you meet him and you think he's kind of a scoundrel, but then he's a really nice guy, but then he sells them out, but then he really felt bad about it. But he covers all of that so eloquently, and it always feels like one character. It's not like that guy in Indiana Jones 4 who double-crosses them five different times, which it could come across as that. But yeah, Billy Dee Williams is great. He has great chemistry with everybody, and I like what they do with him in Return of the Jedi okay. I like that we get more of him, but I always wish we had a more meaty, like, Billy Dee Williams Lando presence in the world.
Yeah.
Because he's great. A great character.
Yeah. Phenomenal character. I love just how much texture there is to him.
Yes.
And you said it's so compressed that you just meet him and get a lot of kind of information about him really quick, and then he has to betray you and all this stuff and get kind of involved in the plot. But I love the idea of this is one of Han's old buddies, like old smuggler, piece of shit. We won the Millennium Falcon from him and all that kind of stuff. And then along the way, he ended up getting these mines and then has become this like responsible businessman. And I love that little conversation that he and Han, or Han, I should call him, have when they after they first meet and are kind of like walking through Cloud City. And him just kind of talking through, it's like, oh, and I have all these labor disputes and taxes. And it's like, what the fuck, man? Like, you're like, next, it's like that thing of like, you know, Han, like, dropped out of high school and left town and then came back and was like, oh shit, you like own a business and is like, I've gone nowhere with my life, Lando.
Yeah.
You're still wearing capes though, I guess.
Lando's still wearing capes. There are two moments in particular that I kind of think of when I think of Lando Calrissian. There's the first scene, obviously, that's separate.
Yeah.
Because that's such calling Han a scoundrel and then they hug and everything.
And the best part of that scene is when he just, like, waves off all this. It's like he brought this whole armed escort that he's like, you guys can go.
The joke worked. Like,
yeah.
He bought it.
Like, we did it. It's like, oh, fuck. I better get overtime for this.
Yeah, exactly. But the two scenes I was thinking of is when he's uncuffing Chewie and Chewie starts strangling him and he has to like sell through being choked like, Han, I'm trying to help Han. That's just, but the turn is great because it really, because he's under extreme duress, it really sells that like, Lando's not a bad guy deep down.
Yeah, he didn't want to have to do any of this shit, you know, it's just like, when Darth Vader shows up, what are you gonna do? It's not his fault.
Yeah. And you know, he thought it was going to be kind of a slap on the wrist for everyone, right? So anyway, there's that. And then I think there's also a scene when they're like evacuate, when he's getting out of Cloud City where he hacks like the communication thing and just gives this quick note of like, this is Lando Calrissian, everyone needs to get out of Cloud City. I just like the little like, he is a responsible guy here of like, I should probably take care of all the citizens of this, you know, sovereign like city I run or something. Yeah. There's just little moments like that that I've always kept in mind. But yeah, Billy Dee Williams is just an actor who should just, in general, in history, be in more things, but he makes such an impression in Empire Strikes Back. He's great.
One of the all-time greatest movie mustaches, for sure.
Oh, on the short list. All right, with the movie Solo, I was watching for this too.
Yeah.
I think the timeline can work if you assume they have additional meetings after the movie Solo and there's enough time for that to develop. But if you, if we're meant to assume that, like, they haven't seen each other since the end of Solo, A Star Wars Story, there's no way they would consider themselves friends. There's no way they would hug. There's no way any of that would happen. I do think Solo, A Star Wars Story is trying to set up that this is phase one of the relationship. And I think if there is a sequel to that movie, which there probably won't be now, their intention would probably be to deepen that and have more happen there. So yeah, like parts of it I can buy, like, you know, the characterization of both Han and Lando in Solo, A Star Wars Story feels very much like it could progress into these individual characters. But I think I know what you're going to say, which is that
it's just like the need that, like, everything happened in that one movie just feels weird. Like, right. And it specifically, it feels like Han shouldn't have the Millennium Falcon at the end of that movie. If Solo, Star Wars Story leads to where they are here, he can't get the Millennium Falcon, like, in that sequence of events. Like, it has to happen later. Like, there's just something that's like, that the need to stuff so much in that movie feels like it kind of like poisons it a little bit for me of in terms of like it getting like the cool, oh, like that was a cool thing when you watch Empire Strikes Back, because you do get that particularly with Donald Glover's Lando and then like hooking up to this Lando. And then I also think like in those scenes in particular, I can feel more like a pretty strong connection from the Aaron Reich Solo to Harrison Ford Solo. But like the rest of it just feels like contrived in a weird way that's like, it made me like sort of be like, yeah, Solo, Star Wars Story was an incredibly unnecessary movie to make. Even if I enjoyed it, it's like so unneeded, because this movie, like the relationship that is implied between Han and Lando in the backstory and like two conversations in this film is honestly more interesting than the actual relationship they had in that full like 2-hour movie.
Yes. Well, because that full 2-hour movie tried to show every important relationship Han ever had before he met Luke Skywalker. So little too much for 2 hours maybe. But yeah. Anyway, I did want to highlight one other person on the call sheet here, a creative, because I just found this interesting. I was looking up the cinematographer of this movie, who's Peter Shushitsky, who is a British cinematographer. He's in the BSC. Very talented and has a really interesting, like, filmography. His biggest film pre-Empire Strikes Back, I mean, probably wasn't at the time, but became big, is he's the cinematographer on the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Huh.
That is a crazy, just, I love that he did that. And Empire Strikes Back. He did 2 Ken Russell films in between that, which is insane. If you just look at that, he worked with a lot of... He did a Jacques Demy film. He did... there's a lot of these interesting directors. He's done at least one Tim Burton movie. He did Mars Attacks. He did an M. Night Shyamalan movie. He did After Earth, which, no, you know, everyone falls down sometimes. But what I do find interesting is that he has been David Cronenberg's main cinematographer since 88. So he didn't do, like, The Fly, but he's done... Dead Ringers, Naked Lunch, Crash, History of Violence, Eastern Promises, Cosmopolis, like everything since 88. And that is definitely, like, those aren't necessarily Cronenberg's most famous movies. Some of them are on the more famous side. Yeah. But those are all really well-shot films.
Yes.
And that is a significant, like, body of work. So I just think that's an interesting arc. So he is still an active cinematographer. His last movie at the moment was 2015. But that's still fairly recent. He is 76 now. So he's been working steadily ever since. So, like, cool. Empire is, like, the beginning of his career. I find that interesting. Yeah. I just like looking at some of these people. So, Anyway.
I feel like we can't do one of these podcasts and not say Ben Burtt's name.
Oh, Ben Burtt. Yeah, Ben Burtt. Brilliant. He had the, you know, we had the stirrups on the boots with that was pretty great.
That's, like, the best, most iconic of all Star Wars sound effects. No. Like, one thing... I assume this was probably Ben Burtt, but it's kind of like a weird sound effect, but it's so distinctive, is the Imperial droid or probe, the...
I love
like that. Just the gibberish it speaks. I assume Ben Burtt did that. I don't know for sure.
Oh, Ben Burtt lives to do that.
Yeah, but it's like, it's like one of those things that's like, I guess it's a sound effect. It's a weird, it's like a weird gibberish, sort of supposed to be a language, not... But it's really good, and that's another one that's like in every Star Wars video game ever. They just throw that sound effect on something. It's like, here's a weird evil droid. Just go make it go.
I love the Yeti and the Tauntaun sound effects.
Yes, yeah, the Wampa. You mean?
Oh, Wampa. Sorry.
Yeah, it's not a Yeti. Yetis are on real human Earth in magical space land. They are Wampas.
What's your opinion on the Wampa scene, theatrical cut versus special edition?
I don't remember all the differences.
Basically, in the special edition, they add more full body shots where you see him. Right. Like, there's a shot in the cave where he's eating, like, meat he's eaten while, like, Luke is trying to cut himself down.
Yeah.
And then it's not all, like, because in the theatrical cut, this is the most awkward effect in the movie. It has to all be, like, super tight close-ups on the Wampa's face or arm, like you never see the full thing.
Yeah, one shot I did notice that this must have been cleaned up in the special edition is when the, like, at the beginning of the movie, when the Wampa arm comes up to knock Luke off the Tauntaun, you can, like, it's like only a couple of frames, but you can definitely see the end of the Wampa arm poking up that's, like, not white fur, and it's, like, clearly something on, like, a stick that someone, like, yes, a stagehand is swatting at Mark Hamill with. So you can kind of see that. I think, like, I didn't even really notice because in my head, I'm so much more familiar with the full-bodied Wampa that I think I just filled in all the blanks and didn't even really realize it.
It is one special edition change I actually like because I don't think they just full-on CGI the Wampa. It looks good. Like, it fits into the flow. It doesn't break the pacing. Like, there are other changes that are fine, but I think break the pacing. Like, they add an extra shot of, like, them going into Cloud City and flying through all the city. Yeah. But, like, they've already been flying, so it's just yet another scene of establishing them getting there, and it's just unnecessary. There's a lot of little things like that, but I do like the full Wampa just, like, eating things. It's kind of fun.
It's good, but yeah.
I'm pro Wampa. Pro Wampa. All right. Well, Sean, question of the day, I guess.
Okay.
Is Empire Strikes Back the best Star Wars movie?
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, of course.
Yes.
Like, it's... There are a lot... Like, so far, we have only watched good Star Wars movies.
That's true.
On this podcast.
I like Star Wars movies, and I do think Empire is the best. I think I've always kind of wavered between this and A New Hope, and they're both very good, but I do think Empire is the best film. I think it's the best directed Star Wars film.
Yeah.
I think it's got a lot of superlatives to its name. I think probably now the second best directed might be The Last Jedi, if we're just going on direction and not all the other things that come into play. But yeah, it's a special movie. It is an influential movie. It is one of those movies that you have to work a little bit now to kind of put yourself in the headspace of being able to watch it and not watch all the things around it.
Yeah.
But if you can do that, it is super rewarding. And I am very excited to watch Return of the Jedi because that one is actually easier for me to go into stripping all the other things around from it because people don't talk about Return of the Jedi as much.
Yes, Return of the Jedi is probably like the most interesting Star Wars movie for me in just terms of like
it's got
the best scene and, like, sequence in any Star Wars movie for me. That is the opinion I have.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, we'll see if I still feel that way after we watch it. But, yeah. But then it also has just some of, like, the most, like, messy, weird bits of plotting and stuff that just, like, don't quite work. It's a strange film.
I am very excited. It's the one it's the main reason I wanted to do 4, 5, and 6.
Yes.
It's because I think we've had good discussions on 4 and 5, but they're really good. We still think they're really good. I'm very curious to when we apply this same lens to episode 6. Because I think 6 goes in the same bucket as the prequels. It's a more complicated film to talk about.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited to talk about it. I think we'll get back to that fairly soon because I don't want to wait a month to watch
Return of the Jedi. And there's not that much happening right now. There's not, like, big games aren't coming out until, like, September. So.
Yeah. So we'll figure it out and then we'll figure out where we go from there. Every episode of The Clone Wars, 1 week at a time. No, I'm kidding.
I fucking do it.
Okay.
That'll
take a long time.
Yeah, I was rewatching The Clone Wars at one point and then kind of fell off a bit because it's like, I've watched the show twice. So it's like, this is a bit much. This is a bit excessive.
All right. Well, that's The Empire Strikes Back for you. We will be back soonish at some point with our last big Star Wars discussion of these 6 movies. Not ever, because it never fucking ends. We'll see you guys next time.
Star Wars is never going to end, is it? How many movies are they going to make? How many podcasts are we going to do?